This episode of the Rick Emerson Show is made possible by our good friends at Squires Electric, a brand new business partner. Squires Electric is a full-service electrical contractor for all of your residential and commercial needs. You can contact them at 503-252-1609, or for more information, go to squireselectric.com.
Revised Scholastic Films presents The Truth Behind Christmas at Clear Channel. Yes, it's Christmas time at Clear Channel Broadcasting Incorporated. And it's the happiest time of year, where employees celebrate giving and the spirit of Christmas, while Clear Channel celebrates wonderful year-end returns and fat executive bonuses. However, some people crazily believe that large corporations don't care about their employees. With Clear Channel, this couldn't be more untrue. Look here, it seems that Clear Channel has organized a corporate secret Santa program, where each employee gets a gift from a secret corporate philanthropic specialist. Jimmy received a pink slip of paper, no doubt containing an uplifting holiday message from the company. Look at Jimmy jump up and down, screaming at the top of his lungs, probably trying to thank Clear Channel for their holiday generosity. There are always holiday festivities going on at any of the 1.75 billion Clear Channel radio stations at Christmas time. Wow, look at the happy employees cleaning out their offices, probably to make room for the tree and the upcoming Christmas feast that Clear Channel has undoubtedly organized. Does Clear Channel Broadcasting care about the Christmas spirit? You're damn right they do. Look at this formerly high-paid executive. He used to be cooped up in a dingy office every day. But now, thanks to Clear Channel, he's working as a corner Santa Claus. Wait a minute, you're supposed to wave with all of your fingers extended, Santa. And here you see another employee being escorted out of the building by security, probably so he can experience the crisp, cool weather, which will make him even more into the Christmas spirit. Apparently, this employee had asked to have Christmas Day off, so Clear Channel responded by giving him several years of vacation time. What a generous company of friends. And of course, since Clear Channel is a large corporation that makes hundreds of millions of dollars per year, they are incredibly charitable. Here they are hiring a homeless person with no broadcasting experience whatsoever to be one of their highest profile hosts. Some would say they would hire anyone or do anything just to save a buck. But this homeless junkie, soon to be talk show host, doesn't think so. Say hello to the camera, Glenn. And that's the generous truth behind a Clear Channel Christmas.
Well, I tell you what, maybe we'll have ourselves a little Christmas right here. Come on, everyone, gather around. String up the lights and light up the tree. We're gonna make some revelry. Spirits are high, so I can tell it's Christmas time in hell. Demons are nicer as you pass them by. There's lots of demon toys to buy. The snow is falling and all is well. It's Christmas time in hell. There goes Jeffrey Dahmer with a festive Christmas ham. After he has sex with it, he'll eat up all he can. And there goes John F. Kennedy, caroling with his son.
Reunited for the holidays, God bless us everyone.
Everybody has a happy glow, let's dance in blood and pretend it's snow.
Even Mao Zedong is under the spell,
it's Christmas time in hell.
Adolf, here's a present for you.
Oh, a Tannenbaum!
Yes, a Tannenbaum. God cast me down from heaven's door to rule in hell forevermore. But now I'm kind of glad that I fell, because it's Christmas time in hell.
Here's a rack to hang the stockings on. We still have to shop for Genghis Khan.
Michael Landon's hair looks swell. It's Christmas time in hell. There's Princess Diana holding burning mistletoe. Over poor Gene Siskel's head, just watch his weenie grow.
For one day we all stop burning, and the flames are not so thick. All the screaming and the torture stops as we wait for old St. Nick. So string up the lights and light up the tree. We're damned for all eternity, but for just one day, all is well. It's Christmas time in hell.
Gather close together and make it quick. We gotta make room for Andy Dick. Wake his mother and ring the bell. It's Christmas time.
Christmas time.
It's Christmas time in
26 minutes after the hour of 1 in this, the month of November in the year of our Lord, 2010. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. Thank you for drawing near that ye might be entertained and amused on this Friday. It is Friday, November 26th, 2010. The day after Thanksgiving, and welcome to day 12, friends, Romans, neighbors, countrymen, children of all ages, and enthusiasts of conversation and amusements from across the fruited plain. It is 503-505-6964, if you would like to join us today with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, ponderings, recipes, whatever it is you might have. It's 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. 6964. You can also message us via Skype if you would like. It's Rick Emerson Show. That is our Skype username. Rick Emerson Show at Skype. And you can email. It's Rick at RickEmerson.com. Rick at RickEmerson.com or Dawn, D-A-W-N, at RickEmerson.com. And the chat box is open and all of that as well. Hello, Dawn Taylor.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. I was just looking at Facebook. I had posted this photo, which you can actually see if you go to Rick Emerson Show pictures, RickEmerson.com pictures. When I was coming into work this morning, I got coffee, and on the corner by the coffee place, there was this person in a pig costume.
Is this the thing you showed me this morning?
Yeah.
That's the saddest photo I've ever seen in my life.
But the thing is, and we'll talk about that in a second, but the thing is, I posted this picture, and it's this poor sad person in a pig costume with a sign standing on the corner in the rain this morning, the Friday after Christmas. But I posted it to Facebook, and, you know, Facebook does that thing where they suggest things in the corner.
Right.
The Google ads automatically suggest things based on some algorithm from what you've posted. So I'm not sure how the sad pig in the rain, you know, led to this, but the ads along the thing are a Barnes & Noble ad suggesting I read less than zero, a recipe for carrot cake, and an ad for a vocational ministry program at Northwest University in Kirkland, where I could get a master's degree in ministry.
Because of a guy in a pig outfit.
Yeah, so less than zero, make carrot cake, become a minister. Because I posted a picture of a sad person in a pig suit.
Could this have something to do with the incredibly disturbing picture you put up of a swollen-headed baby?
No, that's something entirely different. I did not post that to Facebook.
Okay.
That's for a story I'm reading later.
Oh, I see. So that's just in the visual aid section. That hasn't,
yeah.
That hasn't graced your Facebook page.
No.
So the people who are just looking at Facebook, they have been spared that particular photo.
Right.
Okay. I myself was not, because I went just now to look at the pig picture,
yeah.
Which is awesome, by the way. Let's have no illusions about that. The pig picture is glorious in a sort of horrible there, but for the grace of God, go
yeah.
all of us sort of fashion.
I felt so sad. I got the coffee, and you can see the Dutch Brothers coffee place in the background. And I pulled out, and I came up to the corner to turn right, because I'm on my way to work, and there was this person standing. And I'm always kind of freaked out by people in animal outfits, because for the same way I'm afraid of clowns, I'm a little bit afraid of people in mascot suits. So it kind of took me aback. But I couldn't be frightened because I just felt so sad for them. And this person, and they looked at me, they just waved, and I waved back and then grabbed my phone and went, click.
And, you know, here's the thing. If you had been looking back, all right, I was going to put a pin in this for just a second. Hello, it's the Rick Emerson radio program. It is Friday, November 26, 2010, the day after Thanksgiving, which we are now legally required to call Black Friday, apparently. So coming up today, we got your penis watch, Rick Emerson's Joy of Christmas. That reminds me, I got to find the Joy of Christmas, the actual sounder. I have it in my files. I got to dig that up. So we'll have the inaugural edition of Rick Emerson's Joy of Christmas coming up here later on. Mr. Big Jim Willig will be in the studio later on for another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. Today, looking at the life and career of Ms. Joan Rivers. We'll also do the top five Black Friday songs. So these are songs with Black or Friday in the title, correct?
Yes.
Okay. I'm predicting two of them right now. I'm not going to say them out loud, but I got to make a little wager in my own head about whether or not certain songs are going to appear on the list.
I will say that as sad as it will make Jenny Hieronymus, Black
by Pearl Jam.
By Pearl Jam is not one of them. We just played that like a week or so back.
Say that I was in a coffee shop the other day, and there was the weirdest thing. It was the children's choir singing an a cappella version of Black by Pearl Jam. It was the coffee place by Powell's on Hawthorne. So I'm sitting there, and I'm having a scone or whatever, and I'm, you know, drinking my Earl Grey tea. And, and it is the weirdest thing comes over the sound system. It was because there's that part at the end of Black by Pearl Jam. That when Eddie Vedder does it, I mean, it sounds... You know, it just sounds like him. But when children sing it, it sounds a lot like Mickey Mouse. And it's that thing at the end. And it was just like this endless loop of children, like Scandinavian kids singing it. I don't know why you would ever record that or own it.
No.
Or put it on the speaker system at the coffee place, but there it was. So that's coming up. Top five Black Friday songs, and Don Taylor is tracking the following stories for you on this Friday.
Well, Texas doctors help a baby with a swollen head.
Ugh.
And it is indeed quite swollen.
Uh-huh.
A man runs over a cop at a DUI checkpoint. And people be shopping.
By the way, if you want to see the pig photo that we're talking about, you go to rickemerson.com/pictures. That is rickemerson.com/pictures. Go to visual age for today. That is 11/26/10, November 26th. So the caption is great, by the way, because you do the comedy of inversion well sometimes, because you're not even really trying to put a clever caption. It just says sad pig in the rain. And the pig is, in fact, just holding a sign. What does the sign say? I can't read it.
I don't know.
It.
It's the something company. It's like it says...
It's
like,
not for Dutch Brothers.
No, it's not.
See,
it's,
that's what I thought. I thought it was like, come have some coffee. Oink. I'm so sad.
No, it's just for some building, because the Dutch Brothers is on the corner, and then over, you can't see it outside of the frame, but there's just a bunch of like light industrial things and a paint store and stuff like that. And it says something like... The bag company or something like that. I'm not sure. The something company with three letters.
Is it something that has to do with pigs or swine?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Just like with these companies, is it just like that they just pick whatever costume is available?
I think so.
Like whatever's left in the store?
Well, there's a barbecue place up the street, like right by
me. Oh, that would be creepy.
Maybe they just hired the barbecue guy to work like on an off day holding a sign.
At least it's not for the barbecue place, because that would just be disturbing.
Yeah.
If it was a lot of, you know, would you like a sandwich of me?
Come eat me.
You remember those ads that Chick-fil-A used to do with the cow?
Yeah.
Where it was the cow and he was holding the badly written sign that says, eat more chicken. And it was just C-H-I-K-I-N.
I liked those.
And the K was sort of backward.
Yeah.
That's always freaked me out, man. It was like some weird sort of interspecies, you know, the rivalry that had taken like a particularly dark turn.
Well, what's worse is, and I'm sure I've mentioned this before, if you go, they may not do this anymore, but you used to go to Red Robin. And at Red Robin, they have, you know, and there's the Red Robin. There's this anthropomorphic Red Robin who is their, like,
oh,
person.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And there's a guy in a suit on the street sometimes, which is freaky. But they have this special Red Robin spice mix stuff, which I think is like the Lowry's seasoning.
Right.
And it's on the table in a big canister. And on the label, there's a picture of the Red Robin, and he has his wings spread wide, and he's sort of... Underneath of his wings, he has all of his little friends.
Right.
Like the pig and the ear of corn.
That you're about to
and,
eat.
Yeah, and it's like every... And a tomato.
Which of my friends would you like to consume today?
Well, the thing is, yeah, they don't serve Robin on the menu. So basically, these are all his special friends that he's happily marching towards their doom.
Awesome. So he's sort of the... he's some sort of a culinary... Some sort of a culinary pimp.
He's some kind of Hitler of animal foods or something. He's just marching them into the ovens, and then you're going to enjoy them on your plate later.
Attention, prospective advertisers and advertising agencies. That was not Rick Emerson comparing Red Robin to Hitler. That was Don Taylor who did that. If you are perhaps an ad agency that represents one of those establishments or any other establishment in the Red Robin family that would like to advertise in the Rick Emerson show, Rick Emerson wholeheartedly endorses that decision and will not make any sort of Nazi comparison with your business. It is creepy, though. Here's the thing about the... Let me just go back to the Chick-fil-A thing for a second. Because if I remember this correctly, it was a cow. The ad was a cow. First of all, the cow was standing upright. He was standing on two legs, but he wasn't dressed. So he wasn't like a fully anthropomorphized cow. Like he wasn't like a poochie kind of cow where he had like a hat and sunglasses and a guitar or something. Like it was just a cow from the field standing upright with a sandwich board around his neck. And the sandwich board said, and it had really been... I was going to scroll by hand, but I guess scroll by hoof or whatever. But it was like a crudely scrawled sign on the sandwich board, and it said, eat more chicken.
Yeah.
And it said C-H-I-K-I-N, and then it was talking about some of the letters were backward. That's exactly right there, and more was spelled M-O-R. Here's what's creepy about that, like, apart from the obvious. What's disturbing about that is, if it was just a cow, like, pointing at a chicken and saying, like, you know, him or something, you know, or just sort of gesturing at a chicken, that would be one thing. If the cow was actually speaking grammatically correct English, that would be another thing. You know, that would be okay. You see, there again, there's three cows, and they're each holding a sign with one word on it. But it's but they're misspelled. Like they're just, you know, like they don't really have the grasp of the language.
Cows.
Okay, but here's what's creepy about that. It would be one thing if the cows actually had a fluent grasp of the English language. At least then it would be a full anthropomorphizing. This indicates the cows are learning. That's what disturbs me about this. This is an interstitial stage. You were seeing an intermediate stage of the cow's grasp of an eventual mastery over the English language.
They have started to stand upright, and they're still
learning.
That's
what I'm saying.
Language.
They can't put on pants yet, but they're standing upright. They can't, you know, it's not that they're not rhetoricians or anything, but they're able to say eat more chicken and to write it out in, you know, something approximating correct English. That's what's creepy. So nobody else. It's one of the reasons they don't ever invite me to focus groups, because I kind of seize on things that I think wouldn't disturb other people. Okay, then see, that's just wrong. That's a cow with a rainbow wig on. All right, I don't want to see that. You have to take those away.
Yeah, okay.
So if you go to rickemerson.com/pictures, you will and visual aids for the 26th of November, you'll see this photograph of somebody in a pig mascot costume. And the best thing is you can actually see your side view mirror out of here, you know, in the photo, so you can see that you. And I like the idea that the pig looked at you and you waved at the pig and then went chink and took your photograph. And you know that if you had looked in the rearview mirror, you probably would have seen the pig go and hang his head, because he was probably waving at you thinking that you were going to take him away from this life of damp anguish.
Hey, hi, how you doing?
And you went, hi, pig, snap. Provide amusement for me today. Dance for me. And then you took a photograph of him because he's like he's some porcine jester that is there just to amuse you and to make you laugh.
You could just see the despair in
his eyes. You know that costume's not waterproof.
No.
I mean, you know he's just squishing around in there all day, just going oink sad, oink sad.
And God only knows when the last, because I have actually had jobs where I wore those suits.
Oh, yeah.
And God only knows when the last time was that thing was cleaned.
Oh, God.
So, you know, now it's wet and it smells like other people's sweat and your head is inside of it.
It just smells like pig crotch and rain and sadness.
Yeah, I was an Easter bunny at a mall once when I was in college. And it was the nastiest smelling costume, like, ever.
I had one of the former producers in the show, Christina Carlson, she had to be the WB Frog one year in, like, a parade of some kind. And then one of the best broadcasts we have ever had, one of the best things that's ever aired on the show, I might have this at home somewhere. Our friend Aram, who worked for the WB, but I forget exactly how it is that he came to be doing this. But there was that kids' parade they have every year in Hollywood, here, you know, Hollywood District in Portland. And it's, I guess, leading up to the Rose Parade. But it was like, it was 5 or 6 years ago, and it was one of those hot spells where it was like 104 degrees or something. And they had him in a Pikachu outfit, like a Pokemon costume. And I don't know why the CW had him in a Pokemon outfit, but he was on his cell phone calling us from inside the Pokemon costume that was on the back of a wagon that was dragging him slowly, like in the sun, down the street as part of the kids. And it took him like 6 hours to get from one end of the parade route to the other. He's inside a fur-covered costume. And it wasn't like the upscale camera. There's a fan inside, like they have at Disneyland. And he just called us from inside. He's like, this is Aram. Turn on your television. And we turned on the television, and we could see, like, the wagon going by. And there's a Pikachu, you know, guy sitting in the back waving slowly at the kids, kind of listing 30 degrees to port. And he just said, that's me. I mean, it's so hot. I don't have any water. You know. And then eventually the phone just went dead. And the next time we turned on the so horrible. The next time we turned on the TV to see, like, what happened to our friend and listener Aram, who's calling from inside the Pikachu. With the Pikachu, it was just slumped over in the back of the truck. He was just slumped over into one of the wheel wells. He could be dead for all we know.
Oh,
good times. All right. In any event, it's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. 503-505-6964. Somebody wants to know if you're afraid of furries.
I am very freaked out by furries. I'm frightened of people who are wearing big suits. And so it's like the pig person isn't so bad, but like that Red Robin suit, like if I'm driving and I stop at a light and then I'm not expecting it and I look over and I'm like, ah, and because the more, it's like with the clowns, the more professional it is, the more it frightens me. So something like this where it's really just a head and then just pajamas, that's not so scary. But furries, I had that thing where I really didn't know what furries were. And I remember going to a science fiction convention with my then boyfriend, and I'd asked him, like, we were in the art room, and I was like, what is the deal with all the art with, like, sexy cats with boobs and stuff? And he goes, oh, well, they're people that are furries, and they're into this whole cartoon animal thing. And that's all he said. And I was like, oh, well, that's weird. But I didn't make any kind of, like, weird connection. And then I read that article in Vanity Fair.
Yeah.
About furries and plushies.
Right.
And I had one of those moments where every time I think I'm jaded and I've heard of everything and nothing can freak me out, something comes along that I went, go, oh my holy God. And so that completely just blew my mind and I was horrified. And then a couple of months later, I went to Oricon, the science fiction thing again. And I was looking for Patrick. I started dating Patrick. And I went down to look for him in, like, the gaming room or something. And I came around a corner, and this guy comes around the corner and almost bumps into me. And I said, oh, excuse me. Okay. And I look at him, and I realize he's got fox ears and a little fox nose. And he keeps walking, and I see he's got, like, a fox tail attached to the back of his pants. And I just immediately just shuddered. I kind of went, ugh.
Did you feel bad?
I did, because he seemed very nice. I was like, oh, excuse me. Oh, and then I realized, furry. And I swear, and I, you know, here's the thing. God bless you, whatever you're into. And I'm not as freaked out by furries anymore as I used to be. But there was a time that it did kind of freak me out a little bit.
Did you
bit.
Feel guilty for recoiling? Like, you came around the corner.
I did.
Here's the furry, and you went, huh! And then went, oh, and then you felt like a jerk. You felt,
yeah.
You felt as though you'd engage in some weird form of racism just there.
Yes.
And you've been caught, you know, like, locking your car doors when someone walked by. And you went, oh, God, I didn't do that because of, it wasn't, just because I'm white and you're, I mean, I wasn't, that's why, I didn't lock the doors because, oh, I'm sorry.
And the thing is, I know for a fact that we actually have some listeners who are furries.
Yes, one just messaged me and has a question for you.
Yeah. And I am not freaked out by furries in the way I once was. And I felt guilty. There was a period, for a while I actually felt bad because I really tried very hard to be open-minded and think, you know, whatever you do, man, in the privacy of your home is fine.
As long as it's not around me and I don't have to see it.
Well, no, I'm going to say the furry thing, I'm not so bad with furries anymore. The plushies still bother me.
Well, that's more odd
that
to me.
That still bothers me. Okay, what's my question? What's my question?
Well, he just, he wanted to know if you had gotten over your fear.
Oh, yeah.
And he says, we all remember the Vanity Fair article, and by we, he's talking about his fellow fur. He says, in the fandom, that article looms large.
Oh, yeah.
Well, because that was the crossover. That was when that particular lifestyle and fetish kind of went mainstream. That was the first introduction I think a lot of people had to it. And I'm unclear from the name here on the screen if this is the same. I think we said his name on the air, but I won't say it now in case we didn't. But we had a furry listener come into the studio one time. He was like an elk or something. And then there's a photograph of him grabbing my ass or something, and he's like in the full, like, hello, elk, costume. And it's.
And I have a couple of Facebook friends and people I've known from, like, years of blogging on LiveJournal when I did that and stuff like that who are furries. And I do realize that there are degrees. There are people who, like, yeah, there's this whole sexual fetish aspect of it, but there are also people that it's really more like, almost like having a spirit animal, and they're into the aesthetics of it and that kind of thing. So, you know, it was like right after reading the Vanity Fair piece to run into, like, somebody with a foxtail is a little disturbing.
Here's the thing. I will say this about the furries, though. They keep their costumes in much better shape than, like, the mascot guys or, like, the...
Oh, hell yeah.
Like, the guy at the tax service that has, like, you know, somebody in a big foam Statue of Liberty costume that's sort of dancing on the corner or whatever.
Or that damn Easter Bunny costume that I had to wear when I was working at the mall, which, man, that thing was rank.
I mean, here's the, you know, and, you know, I, like, yeah, and the furry thing doesn't bother me at all. Like, I don't, you know, like, it's not my deal, but whatever. I don't care. Because really, I mean, how much, like, let's be honest. How far off, you know, is that really from, like, you know, our friend Chris who spent, like, $3,000 in 5 years making a Boba Fett costume? That's, like, unbelievably,
well,
you know.
Well, we know pirate reenactors, and I spent 15 years at a damn Renaissance fair. And the thing is, also, ever since I found out about furries in the years in between, I have discovered there are so many more, like, weirder and far more mind-blowing things that people do that I would never have imagined. So it's like... Oh, yeah. Being a furry is pale in comparison to what some people are into.
I went to that retro gaming convention. I mean, not this year, but I guess maybe it was last year or the year before or something. And there was this... It was the weirdest conflict. You see stuff that sometimes at those, like, especially, like, gaming conventions or anything that's sort of nerd-centric. Things that really... They make you... They are so weird, and it's, like, such concentric layers of... And I mean this in a very neutral way of just perversion. I don't mean that in a bad way. But it's just that it goes some, like, specialized, you know, fetish or some very, you know, focused kind of interest that you question yourself and then you kind of question the other person and then you wonder which of you is really weird. Is it, like, them for having the thing, or is it you for not getting... Like, are you a square for not understanding it?
Like what, for example?
Well, it was... The thing I saw was... It was a woman, and when I say older woman, I mean she was an adult. She wasn't a kid. But it was a woman who I would guess was maybe, like, mid to late 20s. Mm-hmm. It was a... How do I put this? It was a woman dressed up as a little girl who was then, in turn, dressed up like an adult anime character. And it's hard to really explain unless you sort of saw it. But she was clearly an older woman pretending to be a little girl, pretending to be an older woman, pretending to be an anime character. And then she had a purse, like, you know, like she had a shoulder bag or whatever. She had like a purse over one shoulder, and then hanging out of the purse were a bunch of severed tentacles. And I was just looking, and I thought, what is going on here? Like, what?
There's so many layers of story.
That's the thing. It's like I couldn't even find my way through the fetish. I couldn't navigate my way. And then she was gone. And I wanted to ask, like, what is? But there was. You realize there was no way to ask without sounding passively accusing.
Yeah.
Because there's no way to go. Like, look, no offense, but, and I really didn't mean any offense. I just wanted to know, like, what is your deal? Like,
why? You know, here's the thing: is that honestly, when people go out in public like that and they are dressed up and things like that, particularly at conventions. You can ask them. It's just the matter of how you phrase it. It's like I found that you can walk up to somebody and go, I got to tell you, I think what you've got going on here is fantastic, but maybe I'm dense, but I don't know what it is. Could you explain what you're doing here? And they'll usually be more than happy to tell you. But if you start out by saying, I think what you're doing here is kind of awesome, but honestly, I don't get it. What is this?
See, and here's
they'll tell you.
The reason I didn't ask is threefold. One, because I didn't want to seem as though I were judging. I didn't want to, you know, seem to be like, you know, listen here, freak. I have some questions about. Two.
What the hell is this?
Yeah, two, I didn't want to look like some sort of sexual square, you know? Mm-hmm. Like it was, you know, like it's, no, I'm sorry, just, you know, missionary only for me, please. You know, just like I was some sort of a rube who hadn't freed my mind. And third, and this is dumb, but it's at a gaming convention where it was sort of a point of pride with me that I recognized like everything and I was able to identify all of the really weird inside reference. And they had a costume contest, and I was a bit like, oh, that's from Mega Man, you know, or whatever, you know. And it's you know, Larby, like, what's it? I'm like, oh, it's a Metroid reference, baby. You wouldn't understand. And so I saw this woman. She's like, you know, a woman pretending to be a girl, pretending to be a woman, pretending to be a cartoon character with severed tentacles. And I didn't want to be like, pardon me, ma'am, I don't... What are you dressed as? For her to go like, it's Yubashan 5. Hello. And then just to, you know, and like for me just to feel like I was a tool. Like I somehow, you know, like I was a poser for not recognizing like the, you know... Because, like, can I just tell you, there are whole video game sagas now that are, like, at part 7 or part 12 or something that I have never played and I don't know anything about. And it's kind of like I read this thing about the Renaissance period in science where they said that there was a time in human history when one man could know all there was to know about the world of science, about every field of science, biology, geology, evolution, you know, geography. You could know all that was known of the hard sciences and of the explored world. But now you could live your entire life and never understand half of one branch of science. So it is with nerddom. I mean, there's like all of these weird, like you can go on the internet and just fall down all kinds of bizarre 4chan rabbit holes where you have no idea what the F. Let me ask you this. Do you ever come across an internet meme that clearly has been going for like 50 years and you just discovered it?
Oh, yeah. And also, there's every once in a while. I mean, I'm fairly savvy. I'm on the internet all day, practically every day. So I'm on top of this stuff. But yeah, even now, there'll be things that somebody on Facebook and things like that, people will start referencing some internet meme, and I'll have no idea what it is. And I just decided long ago the best way to stay sane is to just go, yeah, I don't know what that is, move on, and then just move on to the next thing.
Right.
Because I'm not going to ask, I'm not going to look into it, I'm not going to give away that I'm stupid and I don't get it. I'm just going to let it go, because I know eventually I will finally find out like what the deal is with the O'Reilly owl or whatever. Eventually it will come around that it will be explained and I'll get it. Or if I don't get it, honestly, I got to figure it's not important to my life, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But if I try to figure out what each one of these things is, and get, like with my husband watches this anime series, Bleach, and he's currently watching something like episode 3,748. It's on like every single day, and it's been on every single day for like 6 years, and he watches it every single day, and I don't know what's going on in it. And we have this sort of arrangement. We have this deal. He watches it when I'm not around. I don't ask him what it's about because there's no way he could possibly catch me up on the plot at this point. And so it's like, you know, fine, you watch Bleach. That's great. I know nothing about it. I love you. Enjoy. Because if I actually, I asked one time, saw something over his shoulder, and was like, so who is that guy and what is he doing? And realized it would take like 8 hours.
And he would have to get a chart, you know, and he would have to, he'd have to go online and print out some sort of a Venn diagram showing you the overlap with the other shows.
Yeah, and it is incredibly complicated. It's not like when he watched Dragon Ball Z. And I would come in and I would give him a hard time and go, oh, is this the one where they fly up in the air and they shoot the fireballs at each other? And he goes, shut up. Go away. Because they do that in every one.
The meme that I actually just saw, and it's one of those things that apparently, again, has just been everywhere, but the meme that I just saw the other day that I'd never experienced before. Because the other thing is there are like site-specific memes or catchphrases, like Ain't It Cool is just, you know, they are notorious for this, where something will... You know, it's usually something from a film or from some like a marketing campaign, and so now the whole thing on Ain't It Cool is like is the phrase the dolphins are in the jacuzzi.
Okay.
As of yesterday, and I think that's from Shakes the Clown, but I don't really know, and even if it is from Shakes the Clown, that movie's like 100 years old, so like, you know, I have no idea. So. But yeah, you just go on to Ain't It Cool, and so every article now begins and ends with, you know, the dolphins are in the jacuzzi, and I'm with you where I just kind of go. Okay, whatever. And then I just scroll ahead to the thing. But the internet meme that I just discovered yesterday is the buzzkill meme, which is where it's a picture of an animal doing something that an animal presumably shouldn't be able to do. And then the lettering on the picture is this very overly pedantic, deliberate scolding of the animal. So, for example... there'll be a picture of a horse, and the horse has got his the horse has got his front legs up on the seat of a tractor.
Okay.
And then the caption will be, you know, horse, you should get off that tractor. You can't drive. You lack the appropriate motor skills.
So it's sort of the opposite of the lolcats.
That's
the
exactly what it is. The gag is sort of that there is no humor in the text. It is an overly obvious and literal correcting of the photograph.
Okay.
There was one where it was like a guy. It was like a guy just sitting at the computer, but perched on his shoulder was his cat, and it looked as though the cat were whispering something in his ear. And then the lettering was like, you know, silly cat, you should not attempt to convey your message to the humans. You lack a larynx, and he will not be able to understand, your speech, period. And there was a page of like 700 of these. And they said, the buzzkill... And then there was a whole description. The buzzkill meme, which first appeared in 2005, and apparently it's been around like forever, and I've never seen it. And I swear to God, I sat there, and I looked at like 150 of them.
You'll be awesome. Come up with something like that. And then, like, create a web page for it and then say it's a meme that's been around for, like, 5 years and see if we can, like, you know,
I'm thinking we ought to do a Philo meme with that picture of Philo. That's the thing. We ought to do, like, a meme off, you know, or a meme, I don't know what it is. But we ought to take that picture of Philo and meme it somehow and then create a whole fake page and, like, you know, make it look like a GeoCities page or something.
Okay.
I'm just saying.
We could spend a weekend just doing nothing but... But Philo meme pictures, and then just loading up like 500 of them to the internet and make it look like it's been around forever.
Well, because I've been talking about this forever, that picture of Philo just screams, and I'm not some guy who just thinks that his dogs are cuter than everybody else.
No,
it's quite the opposite.
It's a startling and hilarious photo.
It does, yeah. It does cry out to be captioned somehow. By the way, you can see this. You go to rickemerson.com/pictures, and then you click on Our Pets, and I don't even have to tell you what photo it is. You'll see right off which
this
one
is
we're talking about.
You're like, oh, you want to see a cute picture of my dog, and you showed it to me, and I just went, oh my God! And I just started laughing and couldn't stop for like 5 minutes.
All right. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Coming up later on, Mr. Big Jim Willig in the studio. We'll also do the top five Black Friday songs. Let's see. We'll do Peanuts Watch, Joy of Christmas, and so forth. Don't forget, speaking of geek stuff, next Tuesday, that is next Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific time, Mr. Zach Whedon will be in the studio with us. He's going to be here. They're going to be showing Objects in Space, which is the final episode of the television run of Firefly that's going to be showing at the Hollywood. He's going to be doing signings of Serenity, Shepherd's Tale, which he wrote with Joss Whedon, and he'll be on this very fine radio program that is coming up next Tuesday, 1:30. Don't forget, this installment of the Rick Emerson Show brought to you by Sorrell's Vintages at 3713 Southeast Hawthorne. 3713 Southeast Hawthorne, right across from the Baghdad Theater, right next to Powell's Books. Sorrell's Vintages, been in business since 1990. It is a fantastic store. One side of side of the store is all vintage. The other side has new merchandise, including a large selection of holiday items. So go by and check that out, won't you please? How was your evening, Don Taylor?
My evening was a combination of terrific and awful. You may have noticed when I was, in fact, I know you did, you commented on it, about a half an hour before the end of our show yesterday, I started looking a little pale and
you were looked a little peaked.
I was looking a little peaked.
Yes. I can tell because yesterday was one of those days where we got to the end of the top five and David Walker was here and we were doing the top five thank you songs. And I can always tell when you were just when you're on the downside of. I thought maybe it was the bourbon, but apparently it was just the. You just had a bit of a day, and you were feeling out of it. Because there's a thing where we get to the top five, and you just. I look over, and you're kind of just. It's like you've gone into sleep mode. It's like you're. It's like you're Haley Joel Osment at AI before you've been activated. You're just sort of slumped over, kind of blankly staring at a wall.
I started feeling woozy, and I was feeling really, really hot, really super warm. And I know it was very warm in here, so I was trying to figure out if it was me or if it was the room, and I didn't know. And I said, well, you know, I had some bourbon, and I didn't know what it was. But I was just feeling really just kind of awful. And I went home and spent the evening being ill. And
when you say being ill,
well, I had a bit of a bout of food poisoning, actually, which, as I learned when I was in culinary school, you don't look at the last thing you eat. So it wasn't any of our Thanksgiving food.
It's like a day before.
You look at what you did 24 hours or so ago. And so I had had some pizza from Pizza Hut that had been in my refrigerator for 6 days. Now, it was in a Ziploc bag. It was still moist and everything, but the... You know, I admit the pepperoni looked a little desiccated, but I thought, it's not moldy or anything. I can eat this. So I brought it to work with me, and I ate it for lunch on Wednesday afternoon, and I'm pretty sure that's what did it because I was really sick. So basically, I spent all evening on the big chair in my living room with a blanket, shivering and feeling miserable, watching Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows on a DVD screener because I am a professional film critic and I can do this sort of thing. So I was, you know, watching the new Harry Potter
movie.
Was it
awesome?
And it is really very good. And I'd be happy to talk about that a little later if you want.
Excellent.
But and then get going, making this noise, going, oh, and jumping up and running into the bathroom and.
Is that I hate to ask, is that like a both ends thing or just one?
It was a both ends thing.
Okay.
Yes. Right. And I don't want to, you know, go into too much detail, but
well, I think we understand that.
Something really interesting happened, though, and I will tell this part of it as tastefully as possible. Toward the end of the event, I was starting to feel a little bit better. I thought I was doing okay. And I just thought, well, you know, I want to settle my stomach and I want to be able to get to sleep. So I drank some Alka-Seltzer cold medicine. And, you know, you pop the little tablets in and it fizzes up and you drink it. And I drank that. And then a couple of minutes later realized, no, I am still ill and went into the bathroom. And I expelled carbonated vomit.
Wow.
Because it was still fizzing, apparently, in my stomach.
That's really not what I expected you to say right there.
And it was, and even while I'm being sick, there's this part of my
brain awesome,
that's
though.
Going, this is really interesting.
So it was like...
It's like I had rabies. I was like foaming at the mouth.
That's what I was going to ask. Actually, it was just sort of so you were like one of those Bath and Body Works hand soap pumps.
Yes, it was.
That just puts it like a foam.
Yes, it was. It was kind of like that. Yeah, because it was like at first it was just sort of throwing it up, and then after that it was like, and then out my mouth just this foam coming out of my mouth.
I kind of wish you'd filmed that actually.
So while I was being miserable, this part of me is thinking, this is really interesting. I wonder if I should talk about this on the radio tomorrow.
I swear to God, when you first told this, and you said the thing about the Alka-Seltzer, I thought it was like going to be the other end somehow, and it was going to
be like a
carbonated, you know, whatever.
No.
It was just going to be something. You know, this is probably better in many ways.
Yeah.
Were you getting that thing where, were you getting to the point where it was that, where you feel like you must be getting better if only because you have emptied yourself out of, like, anything that could be causing you trouble?
Pretty much because, yeah, I reached that point where I was just like, nothing else can possibly come out of me, but I still felt miserable, and I was like, I'm going to go to sleep. And that was the thing with the I'll drink the Alka-Seltzer and I'll feel better and I'll go to sleep. And then I went in and turned off the light and laid down and went, just go to sleep. Just ignore it and go to sleep. And then I just went, ah! And I jumped up and ran into the bathroom, and apparently that was it. That was the last little bit, because after that was done, I felt sort of drained and unhappy and tired, but it was like you have that immediate feeling of like, And there is nothing poisonous nice. Left in me now.
Excellent.
And then I was able to actually go to sleep. But yeah, today I'm feeling a little weak.
You just live in like an international house of illness over there. Somebody said, is somebody in Dawn's house ever not sick?
We have both. The thing is, Patrick's getting better now. So it's like, and I actually said to him yesterday, I was like, can we have like a period where one of us is fine? Because I don't really...
I think you're like you're the Mr. Glass to my Bruce Willis. Because I don't really get sick as a general rule.
I don't get badly sick. That's the thing is I don't get like the big illnesses that keep me down for like a week. I don't get, you know, swine flu or anything like that. Every once in a while I'll have something like this where it's partly because, you know, I do things like eat 6-day-old pizza that was in the back of my fridge. But which is why I wanted to save you from that McRib, I think, is because I know what can happen to you.
Somebody actually says, are you angry at Dawn for not bringing you any of her 6-day-old pizza? I know how you like that kind of thing. So
there you go.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling better.
Thank you.
It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. The show today brought to you by Castalia Language Center, one of our fine business partners. Find out more about them by going to PortlandSpanish.com. PortlandSpanish.com. I want to know how you say I have carbonated vomit in Spanish, because there's got to be a way, right? You know, there's a translation for everything. So we'll look into it. PortlandSpanish.com is where you can find out more about Castalia Language Center. If you took Spanish language classes when you were in high school or college, but you feel like it didn't stick with you, or you mastered it, you had some sort of Spanish acumen or ability, and then it just faded away, it might be because you were, you know, learning it through memorization, which is really not the ideal way to learn a language. You want to learn it conversationally so you can speak it in conversation, and that's what you can do at Castalia Language Center. So I'll tell you what, not to be this guy talking about corny New Year's resolutions or whatever, but I'm just, you know, but it is a sort of psychic turning point for some people. It's like the odometer flipping over. So when the new year comes, if you want to decide, you know, to get your learn on, as the young people say, and keep your brain in fighting trim, you can do that by learning another language. And if you learn a second language or a third language, it develops whole new sections of your brain and actually keep you sharper as you age. So go to PortlandSpanish.com. And so you can find out more about Castalia Language Center, operated by Clara Greville, who's a native Spanish speaker from Argentina, now here in Portland, teaching Spanish language classes to adults. Your kids are probably learning it in school, and plus adults just learn differently than kids do, so you're going to be able to learn it more quickly than you did the first time around, and in smaller class settings of no more than 8 people, and they'll find something that works with your schedule as well. And if you got the, you know, somebody asked me, well, you know, what if my wife and I speak different levels of Spanish, or, you know, I know a little and she knows a lot, they got Spanish language classes for any language of Spanish ability that you already possess, so they can find something that works for everybody. Tell me, heard it here, if you would. That is PortlandSpanish.com, PortlandSpanish.com. At the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
You said any language of Spanish ability.
Did I say that?
Yes.
That's ironic. Sort of a thing inside of a thing right there.
Neurosurgeons at University Hospital in San Antonio, Texas, are helping a baby with an extraordinary problem. His head is more than twice its normal size due to hydrocephalus. 11-month-old Klaus is from West Texas. His untreated hydrocephalus has created a terrible problem. Cerebrospinal fluid has swelled his head 131% above normal size.
And by the way, comments include, holy F, oh my God, the swollen-headed baby. Damn, 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 that's a huge head, and whoa.
Yes.
So there you go.
Doctors in El Paso were unable and in some cases unwilling to help. His family turned to University
Who's
Hospital.
Who's unwilling to help the swollen-headed baby?
Well,
the hell is that about?
I suppose if you look at it and you go, I can't fix this.
How can you make it worse? What could you do that would possibly be, I mean, how could you make the situation any more unpleasant than it already is?
I don't his family turned to University Hospital and pediatric neurosurgeon Dr. David Jimenez, chairman of the Department of Neurosurgery at the University of Texas Health Science Center. It's like nothing I've ever seen before, Jimenez stated. Doctors rushed baby Klaus to the operating room where they put a drain to slowly relieve the deadly pressure. This is something that's probably going to take weeks, maybe over a month, maybe longer, until we get to the point where we're comfortable enough to put in a permanent shunt.
See, I don't understand. I'm not saying that this is like an easy thing. Clearly it's not. But I guess I don't get the difficulty. It seems like they know, you know, you just put in a thing and you drain the, you know, not like I could do it at home with a screwdriver or something, but I mean, but it's a pretty straightforward procedure, it seems.
Well, yeah, but neurosurgery on an infant is a fairly specialized field. And then if you've got a case like this, where like even this guy says he's never seen anything like this before, I would imagine that, yeah, there are an awful lot of doctors that because of, you know, legal reasons and their own lack of skill, that they just wouldn't want to touch it.
I guess, but I mean, I mean, it's not brain surgery. It is brain surgery, clearly. But I mean, but they're really, they're just putting a hole in there and like a tube, basically.
I guess.
I mean, it's the same thing they already do with lots of kids. It just seems like you're draining it for a longer period. I'm not demanding that you come up with the answer. I'm just saying, this just seems like a slightly more advanced version of a thing that they do all the time.
I guess. I mean, I don't know.
I really wish we had a brain surgeon listening to us right now.
Well, the child's father, Klaus Sr., and his mother, Beatrice, are praying for a miracle for Klaus, who may end up blind, deaf, disfigured, or disabled. He faces a long road to recovery and extensive surgery. For the first time, though, the family has hope. Jimenez says the baby is stable. He's doing much better. Ever since he arrived at the hospital a week ago, he's now moving more. He's more interactive. My hope is he's going to be as normal as we can possibly get him. He added, "You never give up on a baby's brain."
Well, seriously, this photo is really disturbing.
It says his head is already nearly a foot smaller.
A foot smaller?
Yes.
So how big is it? Wait, so it's bigger? It's bigger.
Well, it's 131%. Bigger than it's supposed to be normally.
So it got bigger than it is in this photograph, because it's not like a foot across or whatever in this picture.
Imagine an 11-month-old baby the size of – and so that's a kid who's almost a year old.
Right.
So that's a good-sized head. And then the head is damn near three times the size it's supposed to be.
Ah, it's just disturbing. So. All right. Well, you know, there's that that series, the BBC series Hair of the Dog, where they talk about it's an ongoing series about the, you know, science and scientific facts and, you know, whatever. But they talk about the popular misconceptions and the histories of you know, various fields of study. And then the episode a few weeks ago that I was listening to, they were talking about the way that your brain can adapt. And I think we mentioned this story where they found – this seems like a joke. This seems like three different jokes in one. But they were talking about a Postal Service employee in France that had been hydrocephalic as a baby, and that the brain had filled with so much fluid that the brain – you know, her head had filled with so much fluid that her brain had flattened out against the top of her skull. And she really only had about 5% of the brain mass that the average person had. Her brain basically was just this sort of, like, sort of thin strip at the top of her head. But she was smart enough to work at the post office in France, and nobody ever noticed anything.
They weren't sure what to do, because they didn't want to, like, drain the fluid, because then she'd have this big empty brain cavity with a tiny brain.
Yeah, really. Then it's like you're just, you know, then it's like you're just sending something in a box with no packing peanuts, you know, and it just gets knocked around inside. So, you know, who's to say? There could be a flourishing career ahead in civil service for a young baby Klaus.
But that is a... That is just a disturbing picture.
It is really disturbing. So fair warning. You go to look at the picture of the pig, that's like a two-for-one kind of a thing, except the second thing is a thing you don't want. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. Let's do one more. We'll take a break and then have Mr. Big Jim Willig on the other side of this.
Right. An unlicensed and apparently drunken driver struck and injured a California police officer near a downtown DUI checkpoint on Wednesday. At 11:15 p.m., motorcycle officer Christopher Sweeney, an 8-year veteran of the department in San Rafael, California, was parked on his bike when other officers at the Shell station officers at the Shell station at the DUI checkpoint. A pre-Thanksgiving checkpoint was taking place down the street. A driver headed north on Irwin, approaching 3rd Street, stopped his Ford Explorer, put it in reverse, and backed up into the driveway where Sweeney was parked in an apparent attempt to avoid the checkpoint. The vehicle struck the motorcycle officer, who was treated for sprains and bruises and released from the hospital on Thursday. Other officers arrested Guillermo Garcia Rodriguez, 43, of Novato, on suspicion of felony drunken driving causing injuries. Police couldn't determine his blood alcohol level, but said he displayed signs of intoxication. They also said he doesn't have a license. He's in custody in lieu of $50,000 bail.
Okay. Somebody says, I see no pig picture. And then immediately after that, never mind, there it is.
Yeah, the visual aids aren't showing up on the main page, but if you click on the visual aid box, then you get the pig picture and the swollen
head. No, it's there. Yeah, and then, wow, I'm so glad I have today off of work. Nothing says happy holidays like a disturbing, gigantic-headed baby. Time for some Triscuits, I guess.
Swollen-headed baby.
Okay. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. Coming up next, another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101 with Mr. Big Jim Willig. Today, the life and career of Joan Rivers. That is on the way. We'll also talk about we had your Joy of Christmas coming up, Penis Watch, and we'll do the top five Black Friday songs. Don't forget, next Tuesday, Zach Whedon will be in the studio right here at the Rick Emerson radio program. Keep listening, won't you please?
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
We'll be right back.
sleeping night. Merry Christmas, baby. Should it treat me nice? You bought me a diamond ring for Christmas. I feel like I'm in paradise. I feel mighty fine, y'all. I got music on my radio. Feel mighty fine, girl. I got music on my radio. Oh, oh, oh. I feel like I'm gonna kiss you standing beneath that mistletoe. I'm a good old present for my baby and for me. Merry Christmas, baby. Should you treat me nice?
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. In just one moment, we'll be joined by Mr. Big Jim Willig for another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. Don Taylor is also tracking the following stories for you on this Friday.
WikiLeaks may create an international uproar. Los Angeles is getting a subway. And we have our first annual turkey fryer fire.
Excellent. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program, also the top five Black Friday songs, Your Penis Watch, and Rick Emerson's Joy of Christmas. So welcome now to the Rick Emerson Show. Our good friend Jim Willig, who yesterday, by the way, came by in courtesy of his girlfriend Malia. You brought us the whole... How many were there? I mean, there were dozens of those rugula in there.
There were... most of them were pre-made, so they were had already settled and pre-made. But some of them were still warm from the oven, so we put those on the top and sort of like soften the ones underneath.
I got to tell you that I have I think there's one of those left at my house, and the only reason there's one left is because it's a psychological thing where that way I can just tell myself I didn't eat all of them. You know, it's the well, look, baby, it's not like, because if you consume all of them, if they're all gone, then you're just a guy who ate an entire tin, you know, of rugula by yourself. But otherwise, you know, that's a binary thing. You either are that guy or you're not. And so today I can say, honestly, I am not that guy.
What else is Thanksgiving there for, though? To eat beyond your means.
This morning, with my morning coffee, I was deeply regretting that I didn't grab a couple of fistfuls of those and jam them in my pocket.
I offered them.
You did.
Because I knew what would come of them otherwise, that I would take them home and I would, they would just be. And it was that, the thing is, like, We've gone to two or three different Thanksgiving things over the last few days, and every time you go, it's like, what happens? People are just like, oh, I'll take a little something with you, won't you? A little nosh. And I'm like, well, okay. So we take it home, but now there is just – but it's like, you know, she's gone a lot. You know, my wife, she works 12-hour days, so she's gone, you know, and she has dinner and lunch at work. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah. I mean,
are they hiring right now? Or?
You know, here's the thing about my wife's job. Not only – I don't know if they're hiring – but it's because they're never firing, like, ever. So,
really?
Yeah.
So
it's like some
swell that's exponentially?
It's some bizarre alternate universe where there's job security. It's the weirdest thing. It's like
what
it's
strange.
Not like
parallel
our Earth jobs.
Earth 2.
But, yeah, so she comes home, and so she doesn't eat at the house a lot. And it's like, you know, and I'm here, and I don't eat a lot anyway. I kind of do. I'll kind of go a long time without eating, and then I'll eat a lot, and then I'll just you know, forget to eat for the next day or two. But as a result, though, the food kind of stacks up. But that's really dangerous now, because this time of year, it's like our house is one big meadow and I am a constantly grazing bovine. It's like every time I walk through the kitchen on my way to somewhere else, like if I'm going to get the dog food or to get the paper towels or something out of the pantry that's in the back, if I walk by the fridge, it's like this sweet siren song, of ham or something from inside. Oh, I'm so tasty and delicious. You know, and I have to open up the fridge. Oh, okay, ham.
If you're fishing for sympathy right now, there's no way you're going to get it, because your metabolism works properly. Myself, not so much. I watch a Burger King commercial, I gain 5 pounds. You can eat, just gorge yourself on so many sweets and meat and stuff like that. Good for you.
I'm not fishing for sympathy, you dick.
Good for you, Rick. Way to metabolize food properly. Fantastic.
It all goes right to my nose. But as a result, though, I will just sit there and I'll do the thing of just eating it right out of the bag in the fridge, hoping that the people aren't looking in the front window of my home, which looks directly into the kitchen and then into the bathroom.
Meanwhile, wow. Jim and I, we did the thing like, hey, I had a turkey sandwich for dinner. I gained 5 pounds.
Yes. Yeah, I used vegan, non-dairy-based mayonnaise, fresh lettuce and tomato, a freshly baked loaf of bread was where the bread came from. No, with us, it's that simple. You know, you have one thing that has something bad for your body, and that's it.
Can I just tell you that I did the greatest thing last night, though, speaking of eating? Because Lara and I had gone. I did the show. We went home. We went over to we stopped by Aaron and Jen's house to give the holiday greetings and whatnot. And then we couldn't quite figure out what we wanted for dinner, because she hadn't worked, so she'd been at home kind of just waiting for me to finish up. And we ended up going to my father's place, which is a restaurant bar on Grand, which is really one of the finest places in Portland. This is one of my finest. It's one of the greatest places that's ever existed. And we actually went there. I think we went there for Christmas Eve dinner last year, because we're hicks, basically. So we went there last night to get their alleged Thanksgiving special, which is just like the same gruel from the kitchen that always is ladled onto your plate and covered with like a sort of mysterious fuzzy sauce. But it's sort of righteous in its own way. But we left. We got in the car. We're like, I don't know. What should we get? Well, I don't know. Maybe, do you want some dessert? Sure. Well, there's nothing at the house. Where should we go? And all of the stores are closed. There's the only two places that are ever open on Thanksgiving once you pass like noon, because Fred Meyer was open, but then again, they closed like real early. So you got to get there like first thing in the morning. So by the time we go for dessert last night, every place is closed. The few restaurants that are open are packed. You know, your Gustav's or the like Poor Richard's or any of those places.
Any restaurant from another country that doesn't have Thanksgiving.
Yeah, or a place where it's like you can go and just get like the starch buffet, you know, like the grandma's, old style.
Buffet.
Well, that's what, you know, any restaurant where there is a guy in a cream of wheat chef's hat who goes, would you like turkey or ham, sir? Like those restaurants are
or
all
both,
full.
You fat, bloated American.
Exactly. Because families, you know, they just like if it's a large family, especially with senior citizens, they just love buffets for some reason. I don't know what it is about old people and buffets, but they just, I think as John Cusack said in Say Anything, they flock there.
Well, you don't have much time left. You want to taste as much of the life fantastic as you possibly can.
Those places were all full, and, and then there's 7-Eleven, but it's like, we don't have much in the way of standards in my house, but it's like we can't go from my father's place to 7-Eleven on a Thanksgiving. It's like that even for us, it's just too depressing.
That's what the pilgrims did. Well, they had brunch with the Native Americans, and then on the way back they stopped off. They got a couple of the cheese dog rollers that you can get.
Can I just pick
up a couple of 69-cent packets of Pop Tarts
and
a roll of mini donuts?
Well, we did when we left. Jen
that's
and Aaron's,
America to me.
Damn right.
When we left Jen and Aaron's, we did this game. We did this game called. Called the 20 game, which is as we drove by restaurants, we numbered them. Restaurant number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And if by the time we got to the 20th restaurant, we hadn't picked a place, we had to eat at the 20th restaurant. So that was the thing. And it's like if the 20th restaurant is just like, if it's just like some house of Tomaine or whatever, like it doesn't matter. You still have to eat there. But we almost picked 7-Eleven as like the place to eat our primary meal because they have these turkey taquitos that are fantastic.
Oh, yes, they are.
But so we go to my father's place. But we're like, well, let's not go to the 7-Eleven for dessert. So we end up going. We wanted to be more cosmopolitan in our choice. So we went to Walgreens. And can I just tell you this? The Walgreens on 39th and Belmont. is one, and I mean this sincerely, is one of our favorite places. And really? Laura and I have our own holiday tradition, which is every year we go to see to the Peacock Lane place, you know, where they do the houses that are all, festooned with lights. And, you know, every neighborhood, I guess, has that, because you probably have one in Tualatin,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and I've done the Peacock Lane thing, too. Actually, do they still do where you can get, like, the horse-drawn carriage from the pub? What is the name of the pub over there?
From the Horse Brass? I don't know. I've never seen that.
That was so awesome. I did that a couple of years where they had like a horse-drawn carriage. You'd make a reservation, go to the Horse Brass, have a few beers. You know, your time would come up to get on the thing. You'd like stumble out the front door of the Horse Brass, climb into the wagon, and then you ride the little horse-drawn carriage through Peacock Lane and look at everybody's house. Then they come back, dump you back at the Horse Brass. That was awesome.
No, I don't think we've ever seen that. And we do that every year, and I don't think we've ever seen the carriage. So do they only do it at certain parts of the night, I wonder?
I don't know. Or it was a few years ago, and they just don't do it
anymore. Maybe they discontinued it.
But they should.
So we do that every year. We'll go to and our tradition is twofold. We'll go to the Peacock Lane, we walk up and down the house, and I ought to film it some year just because I get really, really I get all Simon Cowell about it. I take it, and the thing is, by the time we get to both sides of the street, we try to come up with the two best houses, you know, which house on, each side of the street having one house, and then, some of the guys really go all out, you know, but they just lack the sense of aesthetic, and then there are people that moved to the street because they liked the house, and then they found out after the fact that, hey, by the way, as part of living on the street, you are obliged by the homeowners association or whatever, you got to do this.
Yeah. And so they just put lights on a bush.
They phone it in. They totally do the bare minimum. It's the guy's fine, dicks, whatever, and he'll go to Woolworths and just buy a fistful of lights and just stick them out. Yeah, and he'll put them in a bucket on his front porch. There you go. There's your light. Up yours. You know, it goes inside.
Left a flashlight on the front lawn.
Exactly. There's this house on, and I forget what the actual street is. It's not actually Peacock Street or whatever. It's 40th, basically. It's right by the Laurelhurst Cemetery. You get right by there. It's off Stark. But there's this house that makes me angry every single year. It just fills me with rage because we'll walk by, and it's the guys never fixed it. We go by every year, and it's the same set of decorations. And there's some really beautiful houses on that street. But you go by this guy's house, and he's got it's sort of a tableau or a word like that, but it's like a setup of characters from How the Grinch Stole Christmas, and they're basically cut out of pieces of plywood and then painted, to be the character. So it's these not wood carvings as such, but
targets.
More or less, yes. But it's these sort of hand painted characters from How the Grinch Stole Christmas. So he's gone to the trouble of getting wood, tracing the shapes, cutting them out, polishing and sanding and whatever, and then painting the characters. Except the Grinch that he's got is white, and the Grinch isn't white. The Grinch is
green.
And it's every year, and it's I keep telling myself that I'm going to leave a note for him one year, that I'm going to go up and put a post-it on the Grinch. I have no idea why he did that. And it's just it's an unacceptable lapse in terms of accuracy. It just fills me with fury every single year when I see it. And it's been there for 7 years.
He hates Caucasians. He hates the Grinch.
There's just something about it. So we'll go to the Christmas tree lane every year, and then the next step is that we go to the Walgreens across the street, and we just do a complete walkthrough of the Walgreens. Because a Walgreens at Christmas time is a thing of such sublime horror. I mean, it is beautiful and horrible and awful and wonderful all at once. It is everything good and terrible about America.
It's like stations of the season. There's 12 different sections.
Yeah, I mean, and it's going to Walgreens is like going to a dollar store and the As Seen on TV store and a discount food place and a homeless shelter all at once and a Greyhound station. And maybe a Woolworth's makeup counter that's been looted or something. It's all consolidated into one place.
I love Walgreens, though. And I made some mention not too long ago to someone that I had bought something at Walgreens. And they looked at me and they said, "You seem to spend a lot of time at Walgreens." Because it's every time I stopped at Walgreens and I bought, I got this at Walgreens. But the thing is, Walgreens is the place I go, is my preferential place to go to buy anything. Because it's I can do everything there. It's I can get shampoo, shampoo, makeup, socks, pens, dog food, a 2 liter of Coke Zero, wasabi almonds, everything that I possibly need can be purchased at the Walgreens in one quick, easy trip. And I don't have to battle the the nasty, stupid people at Fred Meyer whom I loathe.
Well, that's the thing, is it's like a smaller version. It's like a traveling, like, compact Fred Meyer. It's like,
yeah,
a pocket Fred Meyer.
Yeah.
So I'm a huge fan. So we went there last night to get ice cream, and we actually got the house brand, the Walgreens, and it's called, like, you know, W Select or something, but it's the Walgreens brand ice cream. And then to put in it, of course, we got, like, Walgreens brand candy, which is just
pistachio and regret.
And it was like chocolate covered pretzels, and it was, you know, it was like five for a dollar, like these bags, and it's like, and the expiration date had just been scratched out on the back. And I was like, oh, fine. And then I swear to God, there was just like a whole section of As Seen on TV merchandise there, where they had like the camouflage Snuggie.
Yeah.
They had the Ped egg in five different colors, which is a thing that it's like, I think the Ped egg is like a thing that you razor your bunions off with
it's
or something.
It's a human zester is what it is.
It is.
That's exactly what it is. You are totally right about that. Oh, awesome.
By the way, I do want to share this really quick here on the phone. Because of my husband's illness last week, I did go to Walgreens and purchased him a Snuggie, and they had the...
Does he know this? Is this a surprise?
No, I have a picture of him wearing it. He was...
It's
one with skulls and crossbones on it.
Awesome.
Well,
I saw the camouflage one, and then I said, oh, look, there's one with skulls and crossbones on it. So
that is fantastic.
See, for me, I saw an interview with the stoner burnout that actually, quote-unquote, invented the Snuggie, which is basically just a reverse robe for,
yeah,
people that want to poop warmly. The thing that bugs me the most is the fact that he didn't invent it. He's just like, I was living in my mom's house for, you know, until I'm like 35, and I got tired of reaching for the remote on the little table there and getting my arm cold because it wasn't underneath the blanket to grab the remote. And so I asked my mom, like, Mom, would you mind sewing some sleeves onto my blanket? So anything, the mom is the one that invented the Snuggie, A. B, maybe if your lazy ass had a job, you could afford to get maybe more money to bring into the household to pay for more heating.
Here's the
or just get a sweater.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Come on.
The thing about the Snuggie is, I don't know, and I'm still irritated about this. I think it's now been 2 years. I'm still kind of annoyed at the Snuggie, which, by the way, we do own one. I bought her one last year. But I rooted for the Slanket because it had a better name.
Yes,
because
yeah,
the Slanket is,
yes,
awesome. You know, but it's like the Slanket just lost the arms race somehow. And the
literally,
Snuggie. Yeah,
literally.
I don't know why that was. I think maybe it was the Weezer endorsement.
My favorite thing about the Snuggie that I just bought for Patrick, by the way, is that there's one of those little flare little things on the cover that says, now with pockets.
Oh, a starburst or
yeah,
whatever?
Starburst.
Yeah.
Now with pockets.
That's fantastic.
Like that's a value-added
fat,
thing.
Fat, bloated American, because you know you need to carry around your Slim Jims and your turducken sandwich for the day.
The one I bought for Lara was great because it came with a book light. because that's a literarily bent demographic, your typical Snuggie user.
I like to read, but it's too dark in here.
I had to go to like seven different stores, by the way, to find one that wasn't hot pink. That was, by the time I bought her a Snuggie, they were all gone except for the hot pink ones.
Well, they're supporting breast cancer research.
Two things. One,
the camouflage one is very masculine.
And it was, by the way, to support breast cancer research.
It was.
I didn't know if you were just bluffing right there, but
I was
that is
totally bluffing.
No, it was like you buy it and it was like it goes to the, you know, whatever, the search for the cure thing, which, by the way, is not going to work, just so you know. They've been chasing the cure's faster, apparently, because they've been running after it every year for like 10 years. So there's
people with cancer, though, love Snuggies. Because, I mean, you know, you're not feeling so good.
And you'll never walk alone.
That's right.
Wait, no, that's a different disease.
Yeah.
I don't even know where I was going with that. well, in any event, so I got to but I went back to Fred Meyer, and it's like, fortunately, I found one at Fred Meyer because they were all pink, and I just said, I went to the guy and I said, look, in the back, maybe in the storage room, do you have a Snuggie that is not hot pink? Did you maybe like out in the warehouse out back or something? You know, could you look? And somebody just like 30 seconds earlier had returned a beige Snuggie, and he actually reached underneath the counter. It was like God had placed it there just for me. And he brought it out and he said, here you go, sir. And you know, and I was like, oh, that's fantastic. And then I took it home and some dick had purchased it, taken the book light out, and then taped it back up and returned it. So then I was obliged to go buy a separate book light for it. So I'm just saying.
The love, the intent was there.
Did you see that they sell Snuggies for dogs now?
Shut the front door.
No, really?
Door. Really?
Have you seen it? They actually sell, they're like, and the thing
I'm
is.
I'm looking that up.
No, and they're, and the, here's the thing is, they're retarded, but they're adorable. And I really had to work to not buy one because they're so, God help me, they're so freaking cute. You look at the front of the box and it's like a little tiny white, like a Bichon kind of a thing. And he's got his little paws sticking out of the Snuggie and you look at it and go, oh, that's so cute. Oh, come on.
Well, you start typing that into Google and you get Snuggies for kids, Snuggies for dogs, Snuggies for cats, Snuggies for babies. It's like everybody wants Snuggies for everybody.
Yeah. The thing about the dog and the Snuggie is, here's the thing about it, is that you want to buy it. And the reason that I end up buying things like that is because you picture your dog being as obedient and cooperative as the dog on the box, who, by the way, is a photograph, a still picture.
Yes.
Okay, look
at how
that.
Adorable
look
those dogs look in their Snuggies.
Okay. And see? That is 1/24th of a second of that dog's life. You don't see the dog going, get this off of, you know, and rolling around and then
attacking
like
attacking its master.
Yeah, you know, just chewing on it and you know, getting it caught in a door, holding a remote control. Even that picture right
the
there,
a little bowl of popcorn.
My girlfriend's mom just bought just rescued a dog from the pound, and the dog came with a Snuggie.
Really?
I kid you.
That's fantastic. What kind of dog?
It's a miniature pincher, much like the other two yapping, ceaselessly annoying animals. I love dogs. I do. But when you're about ankle height and all you do is yap, the urge to punt is
yeah.
overwhelming.
Yeah.
By the way, I just want to say I came up
oh
with this
my,
picture.
Oh, my. Dear Lord.
I want to see that.
I think
that.
This guy is trying to be sexy
it's like
in his
Tom...
Snuggie. Oh, I posted this to the visual aids. This,
please do.
It's like Burt Reynolds in Playgirl, like just rocking the Snuggie.
Oh,
I don't want to see that. Are his legs waxed?
I think so.
Okay.
I think his legs are waxed.
That's the first thing you noticed?
I'm sorry. So she got a dog from the pound with a Snuggie.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's okay. When dealing with a new animal, you don't want it to be as lazy and gelatinous as you are. You
right.
want the dog to be able to protect the household.
Sure.
You know, how is a dog going to sort of do that when it's dragging behind it 5 pounds of fabric?
Yeah, no, and you know, the thing is, Lara knows better because she's tried for like 3 or 4 years to get Halloween costumes onto our dogs. And our dog Philo is terrified of the costume because he thinks it's like a thing that's attacking him. You know, so I'll come home and she's got like a witch's, you know, thing like banded onto his head and he's just looking at me with wide-eyed sort of, call the police, you know, kind of fear.
Call the police.
Well done.
Thank you.
And then, do you have any rubber walrus protectors?
Yes! Thank you. Rick Emerson for the win right there.
And then Max, of course, you put it on him and he just looks at you with that look of contempt like, how dare you? How dare you sully my good features with this conglomeration of rags, you heathen.
I'm purebred.
Our dog is sort of like Hannibal Lecter, where he just has such a rarefied sense of style and thinks that you are just a horrible rube, you know? And so when you were not looking, he'll just shred them and tear them into pieces and then just look at us with a whole lot of like, you sicken me with your lack of aesthetic. So I told him, like, you get the slanket, baby, it's not going to work. You're going to put it on and the dog is going to destroy it, or the dog is just going to sit there and just shriek itself, you know, into a frenzy because he's going to think, you know. So that's why I've managed to resist. But clearly, like, you can sell anything to people in this country if it's marketed to their kids or their dogs.
Absolutely.
Jesus. All right.
Speaking of which, is your dog on Prozac yet?
No, but I brought the prescription, actually. I think I might actually have it in my bag. The dog, the guy, the vet actually wrote, here we go. So this is actually the prescription that the guy wrote for doggy Prozac because he thinks that, you know, because he thinks our dog is you know, is a little on edge about things, which he is, but it's like, you know,
all dogs are.
Well, your wife keeps trying to dress him up in costumes.
Yeah, and she keeps trying to, like, and the thing about our dog Philo is he's just afraid of everything. And I don't know if I said this off the air, on the air, but he actually ran out of the room the other day because I had a glass of I was pouring myself a glass of Vizo, and I had the glass and the ice, and I pour the Vizo in, and as I pour the Vizo in, the ice makes a little cracking noise, and he just bolted out of the room and ran and hid in the furthest corner of the house at the noise of the, you know, and it's like there's just no, and so her solution is to take him to the dog park where he is then surrounded by, like, you know, dozens of people he doesn't know and German shepherds. The idea that that will somehow, like, you know, that it'll, like, burn the fear out of him somehow, which doesn't really work.
See, dog parks are kind of like field time in Shawshank Redemption. Like, you know, they put the inmates out for, like, some field time. They all talk amongst each other, like, okay, so my owner actually wanted to put a snanklet or a what was
slanket.
It?
Slanket.
Slanket, yeah. I wanted to put a slanket on me. What's up with that? And just like, no, you fight that with every ounce of your being, Fido.
But see, to my dog, to him, it's like, it's the Shawshank Redemption, but all the other dogs are the sisters, you know? And he has no film canister with which to fight back.
I like to say, after that point, the sisters left the dog alone. I can say a lot of things.
Are you on a timeline here? You got to roll at some point? Or you?
Let's rock this.
All right. Well, let's do a couple stories here, and then we'll get another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 today. The life and career of Joan Rivers at the news desk. This is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Well, I believe it is time for our inaugural Joy of Christmas.
I knew you were going to say that.
Are you not ready?
Well, let me see if I've got it here real quickly. Let me see if I've actually got it on the machine. That's my own fault. I was getting the Joan Rivers cut ready, and then I failed to plan, and I planned to fail, Don.
Well, I could talk about something else.
No, I think I've got it right here. So, all right, it's the most wonderful time of the year. It is time for the Rick Emerson Show's inaugural Joy of Christmas right here on the Emerson News Network. Oh, wait.
Is it?
No, it's just not playing for summer. Hold on, let me try that one more time. I have no idea. I have no idea what's going on there.
Snuggy fail.
No, it's just not working. All right, we'll have to revisit that. Let's try that again here in just a moment.
Do that later. All right. Okay, let's do a different story. After years of stalling, LA Transit officials have approved a slew of new public projects, including a subway line that will connect downtown Los Angeles to Beverly Hills, Santa Monica, and the sea, halving the journey from 50 minutes in rush hour to just 24.
It connects
to the New York
something
Times.
To the sea.
Yes, to the sea.
A subway that connects to the sea seems ill-advised.
No, that seems like a bad idea.
I don't think they thought that all the way through.
It is a series of tubes.
Yeah, but aren't you just picturing like a pipe that just dumps people in? Ah!
You're just like lemmings, just like being launched off a cliff.
They cut the ribbon and they open it up and the ocean water just starts pouring in one side. And they're, no, we planned badly.
That's like having a subway that connects to a wall.
was this sponsored by Warner Brothers by chance?
Well, the move toward better public transport comes almost half a century after Los Angeles's efficient network of electric trolleys and light rail was wiped away in 1963 in what some termed the Great American Streetcar Scandal.
That scandal.
Well, it is actually a fascinating story. If you go and you look it up and read about it, it's all has to do with public works and the building of freeways and them deliberately, like, doing away with public transportation to encourage the purchase of cars and the building of more freeways.
You're basically building a public transit system on a fault line, which ultimately will fail at some point in time, as it has in the past.
Cynics say that the Los Angelinos will cleave to their SUVs rather than endure the jostle of the subway, but others argue that traffic jams hold little sentimental value for the city's denizens. There's a whole new type of resident who has no cultural opposition to riding, said mass transit advocate Joel Epstein.
Are you called drifters?
The whole old school LA thing that people don't ride subways is a thing of the past.
That's pretty interesting when you think about it, because on the one hand, just from my experience in California, people in California, specifically in Los Angeles, they do have not just like a very strong sense of their own city, but there's also in my experience, a lot of people in Los Angeles view themselves as being like a polar twin to New York, sort of the anti-New York. And so there was a reflexive resistance to anything that they do in New York. Well, they may do it that way in New York City, but, you know, here. But on the other hand, the traffic there is like the worst thing on earth. Oh, I mean, it's unbelievable. So it seems like...
L.A. story. They made that part of the movie, how bad, you know, the transit system is in the first place. What boggles my mind is the fact that they didn't already have a subway system in place as it was.
Seriously.
Well, Well, part of the problem with building a subway line in Los Angeles is exactly what you said. It is on a fault line.
Yeah.
And I think it's only been in recent years that they've actually developed the technology where they can probably safely build them, that they're not going to, like, just kill thousands of people if there's an earthquake, you know, and people are on the subway. So, but I mean, a good 15 years, 20 years ago, they built a light rail line and that actually goes down into a subway into downtown Los Angeles. And I wrote it once, you know, one of those things like when they got the MAX line here where you go, I'm going to ride the train just for fun to see what it's like and where it goes. And a friend of mine wrote it, and it became very clear as we were making our way from south of Los Angeles where we lived up into downtown that it deliberately went through the heaviest working class Hispanic parts of L.A., and that you start seeing people getting on the bus, getting on the train, and then it dumps you out right downtown where in the business district, and you go, so this is basically just to get people downtown who clean the office building.
Ouch.
This is just to get the low-rent workers into
town.
Pretty
much, yeah.
Yeah, and that literally, that's what that whole train seemed to be for.
Well, yeah, to sort of circumnavigate the fault line, why not just have a monorail? Why not take a page out of Seattle's notebook and just have something that's sort of above ground, maybe suspended by balloons or, like, zeppelins. And that way it's
suspended by zeppelins.
There should just be zeppelins.
Yeah.
That would get you above over the traffic. Zeppelins.
Zeppelin rules.
They can land on the roofs of big buildings downtown.
There we go.
I think
not
having,
just for Gotham anymore.
I think zeppelins hovering right over American cities have worked out badly for us. I think if you were to ask the people in New Jersey about that, I think there's a bit of a fractured history there.
Big Jim Willig and I say we need
pro Zeppelin.
We are pro Zeppelin.
Right. I vote yes on Proposition Zepp.
All right, let's try this one more time, ladies and gentlemen. It's time for the inaugural edition of 2010 of the Rick Emerson Show's Joy of Christmas.
An unintended turkey fryer is being blamed for a fire that caused thousands of dollars in damage to a home in Broward County, Florida.
I'm sorry, where?
Florida.
Oh, damn it, I wasn't there.
I know.
I love how Florida, I love how the fryer is at fault.
Yes. The fryer was left in a shed next to a home on August
11th. Rags.
No one was hurt, but everything inside the shed was destroyed. The damage was estimated at $15,000.
What?
Also, a Melbourne, Florida family got some help from firefighters after a fire ruined their Thanksgiving. Spilled grease started a fire yesterday in an apartment. The people inside were able to put the fire out with an extinguisher, but after the firefighters saw that the family's food was ruined, they donated an extra turkey that they had.
All right.
That's sweet.
So this first family, though, they were running the fryer in a shed?
In a shed.
I mean, which is, it seems... That seems ill-advised. Like, first of all, you're in an enclosed space, and it's putting off smoke and heat and whatever, right?
And grease, yes.
And, I mean, it can be very, very big, or it would be, you know, it would be like a house or a barn. A shed, by definition, is small.
Right.
So you're in a small, enclosed space.
Yeah. You say to yourself, okay, I've got this, this 20-gallon container full of hot grease that is being heated up by a propane stove.
Yeah.
Where will I put this? In the shed.
No. Yes. No.
And we're going to shoot at it with Roman candles.
Fail. All right, there you go. There's your Joy of Christmas for November 26th, 2010.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Excellent. Just one moment. We will have today's installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 with Mr. Big Jim Willig. This segment and the Rick Emerson Show in general brought to you by a series of fine business partners, including Squires Electric. Find out more about them at squireselectric.com or 503-252-1609. 503-252-1609. Free estimates. No job too small or too large. They've done everything from a single light socket all the way up to an entire condominium, a brand new office building. If you're putting a different, a new room on your house, if you're remodeling, you're moving your business into a different facility or a second facility, if you just want to make sure that the wiring in your home is up to snuff, if it's a house that was built 40, 50, 60 years ago, maybe from an earlier time in American history when you were not drawing quite so much power through the walls, you want to make sure that everything is going to work properly. properly. Not even just you know for issues of safety. This is probably safe. You just want to make sure that it's gonna work properly. And you're not gonna overdraw things.
When your turducken fryer is hooked up in a shed somewhere.
Seriously, if you. If you decide that barbecuing indoors just isn't efficient enough, you're going to move to the electric fryer.
We cobbled together 14 different extension cords.
Made out of flint and steel, apparently.
What could possibly go wrong?
Contact Squires Electric for advice on how to do all of this safely and properly with your existing electrical system. You can find out more about them at squireselectric.com or 503-252-1609. Any electrical wiring or wiring of any kind, Ethernet wiring, office intercom systems, things you don't really think about till they do not work, till you need them maintained or fixed or installed, that is when you call Squires Electric at 503-252-1609 or squireselectric.com, a proud sponsor of The Rick Emerson Show.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, it is Friday, November 26th, 2010, and our guest is Mr. Big Jim Willig. You can find out more about him at facebook.com/Jim Willig, J-I-M-W-I-L-L-I-G. He is here today with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101.
Thank you very much, Rick. Laughter and comedy have always been the great equalizer, because you can be any age, any sex, any religion, and still be funny. And what's more impressive is that laughter and comedy can cross those lines or boundaries effortlessly. Comedy has a healing power, much more like any doctor can. But our prescriptions are more direct, more instantaneous. Laughter is infectious and at times elusive. Comedy is, by many, many comic standards, more addictive than any drug, more intoxicating than any alcohol. And when done properly, let's just say that comedy can give great sex a run for its money. And with that, I'd like to welcome you to another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101, where each week we take a different comic or comedian, comedic actor or actress, and analyze not just their humor and career, but indeed their impact on the world around them. And this week we've chosen Joan Rivers. Now, Joan is more than just a pioneer for female entertainers everywhere. Joan is the perfect example of comedy rule one, which is never take yourself too seriously. There might also be an addendum in there about Botox restrictions. I'm not sure. But either way, Joan has always been a woman who was very sure of herself, coming from New York, where it's greatly argued that most New Yorkers are more gritty, more tough than the rest of the country. And if that's the case, then Joan had a tough road to hoe, being a female and trying to be establishing herself in a already very difficult market of entertainment. Now, Joan has already been friends with Johnny Carson, with various other actors of the time. She was mentored by Carson for many, many years. As well, she had a show offered to her by Fox opposite Carson, which caused a lot of bad blood. Now, with that, we will turn the mic over to our two people here in the studio with me, Mr. Rick Emerson and Miss Dawn Taylor. What are your thoughts on Miss Joan Rivers?
It's funny you say the thing about Carson, by the way, because that is the thing that people remember her for a lot of times. It weighs both good and bad, because she was Carson's fill-in host, I think, for quite a long time.
Absolutely, yeah.
She was his go-to host, which is a thing that was, you know, such a hotly contested slot on television. Everybody wanted to fill in for Carson. Everybody wanted to be on Carson or go over and sit on the couch after their set or whatever. And she launched this show that competed with Carson, but as I understand it, she just didn't ask him about it beforehand. That, I think, was the sort of the... I think that was the real rub, is that I think she just told him, like, Johnny, I'm going to be doing the show. Really? When's that? Opposite Yours on Fox.
Well, here's the thing. You're dealing with Fox, which at the time, they were just about to start their own channel. So this was at the very forefront of Fox's birth. Now, you know, at least in the entertainment industry, if something like this is going to happen, if there's like a coup of sorts, they don't want you alerting the competition.
Right, right.
So the fact that not only was she beginning the show opposite Johnny to sort of do some competition with that, and the fact that they were friends, and the fact that, you know, she was, for lack of a better term, she was a woman, giving as big a boon as Johnny Carson was. I mean, the Tonight Show was it. you know, if you could get to the Tonight Show, your career was pretty much made. If you could get one set on there, that would guarantee you at least a small moniker of, you know, of success. Now, with that, when you're given a gift like your own show, opposite Carson, they don't want Carson knowing that this is going to be what's coming up out of the ether.
I remember seeing that Joan Rivers show, and it was just the Joan Rivers show wasn't nearly. Did you ever watch that? Did you ever watch her late night show? It wasn't nearly as bad as Chevy Chase's show
or even as the later Leno Tonight Show.
Yeah,
I mean, it really wasn't bad.
I mean, it wasn't that bad at all. It was the thing about the Joan Rivers show that was weird is that they were so consciously trying to go for the young demographic, which Arsenio did much more successfully a few years later.
Absolutely.
I remember tuning in for the first time and seeing Joan Rivers introducing the band The Cult.
Yeah.
And it was when they were touring on the album Electric, and I think they played Love Removal Machine or something, and which is, you know, fairly tame, I guess, by today's standards, but by late show standards, like, you would never have seen Johnny Carson going, and there are, you know, please welcome, you know, The Cult. You never would have seen that kind of band. It was so bizarre to see a hard rock act on late night television, and I think, well, this is like really weird. Like, who is? And I wonder if at that
welcome
point,
welcome back to the Ed Sullivan Show, and now The Cult.
Yeah, it was just such a weird. It was such a weird paradigm shift, and I don't know. Maybe I'm just looking at this through the prism of, you know, it being 20 or 25 years ago. I don't know if even at that time, if Joan Rivers probably was viewed as being too old by the audience that they were trying to capture. You know?
I think so. The thing is that, well, she had already been established as being a stand-up for a fairly long time, and she had not only become like a regular guest host on Carson on The Tonight Show, she was like his favorite go-to guest host, which meant that she was being groomed to eventually take over for him.
Right.
And which is a huge deal. Like, not only was she a woman who was getting to sit in the seat in The Tonight Show, but yeah, Johnny had given her like shot after shot after shot and brought her in as guest host. And it's fairly famous that he saw it as just a huge betrayal that she turned around and took this job to do the show opposite him without discussing it with him first.
And regardless of that, but still, you're dealing with, as a young comedian specifically, I mean, it's easy enough for a white male to sort of get to some sort of zenith in their career. When you're dealing with the fact that, it breaks down exponentially by sex, by ethnicity, to get that kind of pull. Now we've got, like, the George Lopez show. We've got, you know, Minda Mencia, stuff like that. We've got different demographics finally now getting their due in the 2000s.
She really was kind of a trailblazer in that way. And that's,
absolutely,
I think, has been, unfortunately, kind of overshadowed. You know, she's sort of overshadowed herself by just being the Botox chick on the red carpet every year with, you know,
and being mean and horrible and just saying horrible, horrible things about people that aren't even especially funny most of the time.
I mean,
as a comedian, though, when she was doing stand-up, one of the ways she was a trailblazer is that up until she did stand-up, female comedians basically had two options. They would either trade on their sexuality by being like sort of the sexy, funny stand-up, or going the opposite direction like Phyllis Diller, where it's like she was doing anti-sexy, deliberately anti-sexy as part of her shtick.
There were no Tiger Beat win a date with,
win a date with Phyllis Diller.
But Joan Rivers actually, she did jokes from a female perspective, but she was she just did stand-up.
Yeah.
She didn't play the bimbo. She didn't play the hag. She was, you know, for all, in the same way that male comedians of the time, like the 70s, did a lot of, you know, sexist jokes about women. She did a lot of sexist jokes about men. But the thing is, she was really ballsy in her approach.
She was.
To stand up.
The only bad news is, I think she was before her time, because had she been in a much more understanding demographic as we are now, she could have gotten away with a lot more. She was very much self-deprecating even at that time, and that kind of led into her becoming a caricature of herself, which I don't know if that led into the whole Botox and the facelift and everything else, which she makes no bones about. She will be the first and the funniest to point out those points. That's the lesson that you learn as a comedian is – you know, if you're getting made fun of in school or in any situation, if you can cut yourself down faster and funnier than those that are attacking you, you win.
That's the
period.
One of the traps that Joan Rivers fell into is, and this is sort of the way that the world operates, is that she did have a, as you said, I suppose that Phyllis Diller, who sort of, and you know, another person who comes to mind is Lily Tomlin, who was really, really funny, but who had an essentially sexless act, who divorced her act and her comedy in many ways from her sexuality for whatever reason, maybe because she didn't want to be pigeonholed or stereotyped or viewed as, you know, like a, you know, some skirt who tells jokes or whatever. So she
How dare you?
Yeah, so she almost tried to not present herself as a woman in some ways, whereas Joan Rivers, you know, to her credit, very much embraced that, and she did have a strong sexuality in her stand-up. The problem with that is that in America in the late 20th century and even now, obviously, if that is part of your persona, if your sexuality is part of your persona and you're a woman, then I think the pressure increases very quickly and very early to maintain a specific kind of sexuality, you know, and in a very narrow kind of way, which, you know, is what leads people to just have, you know, relentless amounts of plastic surgery, I think, because if the idea is that is part of your persona,
yeah,
and that's the only way you can maintain it. A person who Joan Rivers reminds me a lot of, and is very similar to, in some ways, Bette Midler, who I'm a huge fan of.
Very true.
I'm just a giant fan of Bette Midler and her early stand-up stuff and, like the comedy that she did. Like, when, you know, that
well,
whole
she
thing.
She did the Sophie Tucker jokes.
Yeah.
In the 20s and a lot of that.
Well, she did
stuff.
Comedy
very,
in very, bathhouses.
Very
I mean,
bawdy.
Come on, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, yeah, when she, that whole thing when she was touring with Manilow and doing the bathhouse stuff. And if you ever hear, there's not a lot of recordings from that era, but she took a lot of the material when she did stand-up in the late 70s and early 80s and toured it. And you can hear it, and it is very, what did you say?
Body.
Yes, very.
Yeah.
I mean, it is very, I'm trying not to say brassy, because that's the thing people always say, but it had a lot of balls to it in a way that she wasn't trying to be masculine. She was just being aggressively feminine.
Well, women have balls. They're just mounted higher. That's the rule.
Awesome.
That's the rule right there.
That's fantastic.
Well, and the thing is, you know, because of the fact that she was in a time that, you know, late 50s, early 60s was when that whole thing started jumping off. When you look on YouTube, you can find some clips of Joan, like circa like 1967. She is, you're dealing with women's rights which haven't even been established yet. I mean, getting them to vote, you know, getting the right for them to vote was hard enough. So what other choice did she have except for to sort of like attack herself or her own sexuality?
So I've got actually some of this right here. So this is 1967.
Oh, sweet.
So this is Joan Rivers. She's on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yes.
On April 23rd, 1967.
The way the styles are today, I'm glad I'm married, because if I was single, I could never get married looking like this, you know? And I feel sorry for any single girl today. The styles and the whole society is not for single girls, you know that. Single men, yes. A man, he's single, he's so lucky. A boy on a date, all he has to be is clean and able to pick up the check. He's a winner, you know that. Or a man can call up anybody in the whole world, you know that? Hello, I saw your name in the locker room. I thought I'd give you a quick call. Trust me. A girl can't call. Girl, you have to wait for the phone to ring, right? And when you finally go on the date, the girl has to be well-dressed. The face has to look nice. The hair has to be in shape. The girl has to be the one that's bright and pretty, intelligent, a good sport. Howard Johnson's again. Hooray, hooray. A girl, you're 30 years old. You're not married. You're an old maid. A man, he's 90 years old. He's not married. He's a catch. It's a whole different thing. Yes.
Oh, and so little has changed.
Yeah, it's seriously.
It kills me. We have an extra man. Bring him along. Bring him along. He's 98. Bring him. Bring him. He's dead. Bring him.
This is really, when you watch this, it's fantastic, too, if you see her actual physical delivery.
Yeah.
Where she's not rooted in place, she's not standing stock still. You know, she's got the material down cold, she's got it memorized. And she's not, and it's not like a, there are punchlines, but it's not like a build-up, payoff. It's not where she's setting up the punchline and then knocking it down. It feels not entirely organic, but it feels largely organic, a lot more so than comedians, many other comedians from this time, who are still doing really structured comedy.
Yeah.
And it does have a sort of weird, lovable anger to it. I mean, where it does have that, like, edge, that undercurrent of aggression, but done in with just enough candy coating that it was able to be swallowed by Americans on Ed Sullivan, you know, in 1967.
Yeah, not to sound too patriarchal, but, I mean, it definitely had that masculine aspect, which is, you know, guys can talk about just about anything.
Right.
At the time, you know, the best you could hope for if you were a woman on TV at that time would be, I don't know, maybe on Rowan and Martin's Laughing in a Bikini that with a you know, some paint saying "Ban the Bomb" on you. That'd be the only screen time you would get.
It's funny if you look at the comments for this on YouTube. A lot of the comments are actually, you know, I don't know how old any of these people are, but a lot of the comments are things like, "I can't believe this is Joan Rivers. Does she, you know, is there more of her work? She was actually really funny."
Yeah.
Somebody says, "Oh, hey," or says, "Haha, I'm actually really funny." And below that says, somebody says, "Hey, is this the same Joan Rivers? I had no idea that she actually did stuff like that. She's really great."
And her face could emote.
And that, yeah, I mean, it is, in a weird way, it's like you wish you could just sort of, you know, Clockwork Orange people into a chair for a while and have them see stuff like this from people. You know, from people who, this sounds like a strange comparison, but I talk about, you know, a lot of this with Little Richard, where you look at Little Richard, who has become such a caricature of himself with his appearance,
yeah,
and his plastic surgery and his makeup and his wigs and his, you know, and he's like, he's...
Liberace would say tone it down.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it's like he's got his weird, it's like his weird sexuality filtered through God, filtered through self-delusion, filtered through whatever. And, you know, you strip all of that away and you go back to 1956 and you just see that guy on stage playing the piano and it is a whole different story.
Oh, yeah.
The thing, you know, the interesting thing about Joan Rivers is how after Carson... And I don't know to what extent, I don't think anybody really knows to what extent Carson kind of had her whacked. It was a different network, obviously, but he was, you know, it was a power broker, you know. Even at that relatively late stage in his career, Carson was a guy who wielded a big stick.
Well, oh, and it was, yeah, and it was very well publicized.
Yeah.
I mean, his displeasure, and it harmed her. It really harmed her in the industry because he did manage to just make her look like she was selfish and ungrateful and backstabbing. And that's the thing is that they managed to make it look like she was just stabbing him in the back by taking this
which
show.
I mean, if anything, that would just sort of add to, you know, she was a trailblazer. She was trying to set up so that more women can follow in her footsteps. And the fact that she was given this opportunity and then stabbed, you know, I mean, it was like stabbing Caesar in
right.
the face.
And
you know,
she said at the time, she was very honest about it. It's like, yes, you know, it's been hinted to me by Johnny that I might be his successor eventually on The Tonight Show, but no promises have been made, and this is a chance for me to have my own show.
Well, and you know, and obviously if she had asked Carson, it was, you know, she was sort of screwed either way, because if she'd asked Carson, "Hey, Johnny, can I do this?" I mean, he explicitly or implicitly, he would have said no, because nobody...
You think?
Yeah, because nobody wants the, you know, somebody opening up a competing store across the street.
No, but here's the thing. You're dealing with The Tonight Show. If anything, I mean, yeah, there might be a following for Joan, but I see it more as like if she would have been like, "Listen, off the record, I got this offer." The reason why he was her, Qui-Gon Jinn, if you will, the reason why he was her leader was because he wanted her to have that same success. He saw in her the potential and the talent that she had. If she would have said to him straight up, like, "Listen, I've got this offer to do a show opposite yours, off by about an hour," you'd still have your preliminary 11 o'clock time slot.
That's a good question, actually. I wonder what if she had brought it up with him, what his, I mean, I guess I'm sort of assuming he would have said no, but maybe not. Who's to say? Carson was really, you know, the thing about
he loved comedy.
There was such an on-off switch with him. Where
he was mercurial.
Yeah, well, I'm reading this book about Steve Jobs, and they describe him as, you know, being somebody who is extremely loyal until the moment that he feels that you have backdoored him somehow. And then at that moment, it was, you know, that he is your staunch ally until he isn't. And it was that way with Carson, where Carson had a real on-off switch with people. Fred DeCordova, who was the executive producer at The Tonight Show, there was Carson's... one of his sons died in 86, I think.
Yeah.
Carson was on stage, mm-hmm. He was doing a little monologue, just sort of a public statement about his son dying, and I think he took his own life. And Carson was on stage, and he was talking about his son and just reflecting on it and mentioning, because it had been all over the news, and he was, just, you know, just sort of... I don't know, airing out his personal thoughts about it a little bit and talking about the loss, which is a rare thing for Carson because he didn't really...
It's the elephant in the room. I mean, if you're going to tune in to see Carson, you know that that has to be something to talk about.
And he was such a private guy in so many ways. He would joke about his divorces, but he didn't really reveal a lot of his private self. So he was on the air and he was talking about his son having died. And Fred DeCordova, who always sat right off stage in the wings watching every night show... I mean, it's so, in retrospect, it's so tacky, but DeCordova looked over him and gave him the hurry up sign. Gave him the, literally, gave him the wrap it up hand sign. And from that day forward, DeCordova was never allowed on the set after that night.
Wow.
If you watch The Tonight Show, after that show, they go over to the wings, and Ed's standing there all by himself because DeCordova was never allowed back in the set when Carson was there. Carson banished him.
There's on and off, and then there's like... Straight up, the dude's talking about the death of one of his children, and the guy's even like, "We need to get this, you know, this Alka-Seltzer commercial on the air, dude. Sweet, come on."
But that was a lot of like, "We're not going to work it out. There's not going to be a rapprochement. Yeah. Like, you crossed me, and you will
it's
not
like
be back."
Playing Sinatra off at the you know,
yeah,
whatever. But what's something I wanted to point out was when Joan finally went forward with her show, she decided, you know what. Overall, maybe this, I can't speak for her, but overall, this is the best thing for not just herself as an act, but as for women on the whole to do the show. The show fell through rather easily because of the fact that, you know, you've thrown a rock at the wrong person. You threw a rock at Johnny Carson. Obviously, that's going to be people that are like, maybe I would have supported her, maybe I wouldn't have, but now because of this whole bad blood, my affinity is for Johnny, whatever. You know, she went ahead with it, and like maybe 6 months into it, Fox pulls the plug, and not only that, shortly thereafterwards, her husband, Edgar, who was one of the producers, ends up taking his own life because of the shame and everything else that sort of went along with that. So I mean, you throw all that together, and the fact that she's still out there, still doing, and you can tune into Comedy Central, or like she's doing Vegas acts. She is still very much, you know, a force to be reckoned with. You look at her, and it's so easy to be like, she's just some plastic surgery addicted, whatever. She has gone through so much.
Well, and everybody's still, I mean, she's still a contemporary celebrity.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like she's just, you know, like she's out there just, you know, on the oldie circuit singing the same five songs.
Exactly.
You know. Mr. Big Jim Willig, Humor Me, Comedy 101, Joan Rivers. You can find out more about Jim Willig at facebook.com/Jim Willig, JIMWILLIG. We'll be back on the other side with the Penis Watch and the top five. Is the top five songs, Black Friday appropriate songs, yes?
Yes.
The top five Black Friday songs. So this is songs with either Black or Friday in the title. That is straight ahead. You're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Stay right there, won't you please?
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Boys. got nothing while you're drinking down your wine. We got no time for your silly toys. Father Christmas, please hand it over. We'll beat you up, so don't make us annoyed.
It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. And just a short while, we'll do today's top five. The top five songs for Black Friday.
What?
Are you just did a thing there.
What kind of a thing?
I couldn't tell if that was a food spill or if that was just a wiping off of the... The sleeve.
No, I think I did a thing with my hand on my lip. My lips are slightly chapped.
Okay.
And so I took a swig of the Vizo, and the citrusy Vizo kind of burnt my chapped lip a little bit, so I wiped my lip.
Vizo, it burns!
Here, use
with
more.
Flavor.
Oh, no, I couldn't possibly use it.
Oh, that's
your,
awkward.
Come on, it's chapstick amongst friends? Come on.
No, because I don't know.
That's just all a... Right. No,
that is one of those things.
Dawn's a little OCD.
I'm only OCD about certain things. No, I can't use someone else's chapstick.
It's inadvertent mouth-to-mouth contact.
Yeah, so we're not implying anything about your... anything about your mouth, of course.
Now, if you were,
your filthy, filthy mouth.
If you're often, like, make out with me or something, you know, that I think about, except, you know, your girlfriend is right across
right
the room. But and yet...
It's a progressive city, Jim.
And yet, using your chapstick is off-limit. That's a no.
Well, I can validate that. You are a woman of principle. There's nothing wrong with that.
She's Dawn Taylor, kids.
Thank you.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
I'm classy. So we should do this penis watch whenever you're...
Here is your penis watch for Friday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. That's another part of the class.
Enormous penis, and my troubles start a melting away. I take a look at my enormous penis, and everything is going my way.
Here is your penis watch for Friday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
Psychiatrists in the central Colombia city of Neiva are trying to figure out what to do with a local man who nearly castrated himself with an improvised penis ring before running into the streets naked.
Wait, so this wasn't, was it an intentional near castration?
I don't think so.
Or was it like he made his own penis ring and then he didn't make it probably, he didn't consult the...
things to do
popular
for the
mechanics.
Day. Pick up dry cleaning, buy milk, cheese, castrate oneself.
God, you put this picture of the Snuggy guy up in the visual aids catalog. I thought you were joking about that. I'm sorry.
Sexy Snuggy guy.
Caught me off guard.
There's Snug and then there's really Snug.
I thought the thing with the massive-headed baby was disturbing. It's just a whole series of disturbing photographs.
Sad pig in the rain. Oh, I don't think Jim has seen the
swollen-headed
sad
baby.
Rain.
You don't want to see that.
Yeah. No, thank you.
And then the snuggy, sexy guy.
I just watched Human Centipede, so I don't need any more.
No. Okay, I'm sorry. Yes, the improvised penis ring.
Yes. According to a local newspaper, the man was arrested by cops who saw him wandering around naked. The security officials decided to take the man to the hospital as he had a ring normally used to play the game Toad in the Hole.
Is that like playing cornhole?
I think so, yes.
What is Toad in the Hole?
I'm not sure.
Do you really want an answer to that question?
It was shoved over his penis and was cutting off the blood supply to his sexual organ. The man had shoved the toy ring over his member to increase the pleasure of masturbating, but was unable to remove it. According to a local sexologist.
What? Okay, where did this happen?
Colombia.
Colombia, the country, not
yes,
Colombia, South Carolina.
No, in South America.
Okay, all right.
Doctors were able to carefully but quickly remove the ring as blood had begun clotting in the penis, which could cause gangrene.
Stop.
And in turn would have forced the doctors to amputate the man's
penis.
Hold on,
toad. Okay, look, let me just say this. I typed in toad into Google. I am fascinated by the Google like autocomplete or the, you know, the suggestion thing where it drops down the menu of like, are you typing for? First thing was toad the wet sprocket. The second thing is toad in the hole. So let's see, toad in the hole. Now, toad in the hole is a food.
Well, there is a food, yes. The toad in the hole, which is a British thing that's a sausage inside pastry.
It is a sausage inside a Yorkshire pudding. Let's see, usually served with onion gravy. Let's see. Oh, for the game. Oh, here's toad in the hole, the game. I want to know exactly. Toad in the hole is a pup game involving throwing brass coins at a lead or lead topped with a LEAD, but I don't know, a lead topped table with a hole in the middle. A variation on the game has been blah, 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 blah. But I'm unclear.
Well, I guess instead of using coins, they were using little metal rings.
The game itself involves throwing four brass coins or toads from the same distance as a dartboard. So it's like a ring toss, basically.
Yeah. When you're too drunk for darts, let's move on
now,
to toad in the hole.
I don't know a lot about a lot, but it seems like if you're going to be jamming something over your member, it would be a thing that was adjustable.
You'd think.
I mean, you know, that's really like where your estimation of size is crucial. That's, you know.
I don't actually, you know, own a penis personally, but I would probably make sure things were adjustable if I was jamming my penis into them, yes.
You barter for one occasionally.
Removal.
Yes.
Removable would be a good option.
The
we call King Missile.
That's
right
sort
now.
Of a, yeah, that's like a, you want a quick release mechanism on that of some kind.
The urologist performed circular pressure on the penis so that the accumulated blood would flow and fulfill its usual route.
So to speak.
However, doctors were not able to prevent damage to the organ, and the man is now likely to suffer an erection deficiency.
No.
As his penis will no longer have elasticity.
Okay.
So it's disappointment in the hole.
He was also sent to a local mental hospital and given anti-inflammatory medicine so his swollen penis can return to its normal size.
So what are you in for? Yeah, toad in the hole.
I don't understand several things about this story, but the thing number one, the first is this, and this is like the same with the what's his name, David Carradine, and the whole the choking and the hanging and the masturbating and the whatever. Because didn't Michael Hutchins go that way too?
Yeah, in
is
excess,
there a third guy?
Yeah. Was it Bob Crane?
No, that was a bludgeoning. Yeah. That was a full-on beating.
And Fox Mulder is going to die from that. We know from the X-Files.
How do you know that?
Because of the episode where Peter Boyle could see the future and he could see how people were going to die.
Really? And he died of autoerotic asphyxiation?
Yeah, there's a scene.
That is
awesome.
That's
fantastic.
Oh, bye.
There's a scene in that episode. They're sitting in the car and Peter Boyle looks over at Mulder and he says, oh, by the way, autoerotic asphyxiation is no way to go. And Mulder says, why? What do you mean? He's like, no reason.
Wow.
Wow.
I didn't. When was that?
That was season 3.
I don't remember that at all.
Oh, damn you, Chris Carter!
Okay, well, fair enough. But here's the thing that I don't get about that. I don't understand. Maybe I'm doing it wrong or right or whatever, but I don't understand people who have to do a thing like choking themselves like to make sex more pleasurable. I mean, maybe one of us in that equation is doing sex wrong. If you're having to do something to make sex, quote, feel better.
But don't you have like I'm not saying that this is right, but don't you have a small question mark in the back of
your mind? Curiosity?
It's like, you know, what is it that dude's enjoying that I'm sort of missing out on?
But I mean, it's like I just don't. It makes me wonder if you're doing that, if maybe you're doing sex wrong from the beginning, and that's why, I don't know, it's just, I don't feel anything. Maybe I'll try choking myself. Maybe that'll work.
Sex with a chain link fence seems to be lacking something.
It just seems like that's a sensation that's sort of maxed out under just normal circumstances.
Well, it actually reminds, there was a, I can't remember who the stand-up comic was that did the particular joke, but I remember a stand-up comic saying something about dating a girl and she had a stud in her tongue. And he said, you know, why do you have the stud in your tongue? And she said, well, it's to increase pleasure during oral sex. And he says, and so, yeah, because that's the thing. Let's take the thing that is the most awesomely wonderful feeling thing in the world. Let's just introduce a piece of metal to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, it doesn't seem like that needs a lot of augmenting. So.
Yeah. See, for me, it's more like we do sell things at the store where I work.
Oh, I guess you'd be the guy to ask.
Yeah,
really,
exactly.
Working
at this. Come on.
In adult erotica and associated items.
Bread and butter, baby.
But you guys, well, you don't sell anything
Malia's
that's used
sitting
for
over
like.
They're just smiling smugly.
Like, yes, he is.
Now, do you guys? Now, do you guys both work at that establishment?
No.
Okay.
No, no.
So you don't sell something that's like to collapse your carotid artery or whatever, though.
Well,
I mean, not officially.
We don't have like designer nooses or anything like that, like the NXS.
You should totally do that. They should completely sell an NXS noose or just some rubber tubing.
As heard on the Rick Emerson Show.
Wow.
No, we sell things that are. Because obviously, when you're asphyxiating yourself, there's a lack of oxygen to your brain.
Right.
The whole rush is what you're trying to enhance. We do sell things that are guised under inhalants or
VCR head cleaner.
Yeah, basically that's it.
So I'm told.
See, wait, that's the first thing you jump to. Not like you know, like Blu-ray cleaner or anything.
Fred told me about that.
But no, we have several things that you can buy, and they're like tiny little vials that you inhale, and the fumes from which lighten your head a little bit, and they give you like a little a buzz when that sort of when the climax happens. So that's I guess the easier, less lethal way.
I like things that are less lethal.
Yeah, as I would too, like a beanbag gun.
So this is what you're, and I don't know if this is in fact what you sell, but usually like amyl nitrate is what you're,
yes,
what you're referring to there. Which,
in essence, yeah.
And it's great because I'm not talking about your fine establishment, and I'm not indicating that there's any untoward product or service being offered.
No, curses.
But you know, at other places and other businesses, and what's great about it is you see that stuff, and it's sold. It's sold again for some ostensibly industrial purpose,
yeah.
Like, you know, like cleaning grease stains in your driveway. But then the name of it is like Rush, you know, and it's got a picture of a guy in the front who's,
you
know.
How did you know?
I'm just, you know, it's a thing that
we sell Rush.
The kids talk about it, you know, on the street, the bowling alley.
Yeah.
You know, or to, you know, be like Bolt Maximum Pleasure, you know, grease remover or something. Or, you know, it's like made to like, what's this? Well, it's to clean your dishwasher.
It's oven cleaner.
Yeah.
Yeah. My question is this. I mean, who was the guy cleaning his driveway naked? And, you know, at some point of flagrante delecto before he actually achieved the end result, he's like,
you
this
know
smells fantastic. Oh, my God!
Yeah, I read a description of that stuff one time because I had a friend years ago, a friend who worked. She worked in a what we used to call a nudie booth.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
She was in one of those plexiglass booths where the guy puts in 50 cents and the little door comes up and then she like gyrates and then the door comes down and he has to put in more money to whatever. And we were just friends, but she didn't have a car all the time, and so I would sometimes go pick her up because we were going to school together. And I would sometimes go. I swear to God, she was doing it to put herself through college. It sounds like a joke. But this is like the one semester I went to like a broadcasting class before
the
I just.
The coolest broadcasting class
seriously.
Ever.
And she's like, one day, just as a side, she's like, can you come pick me up from work? I'm like, where do you work? And she's like, you know, and I forget
Mr.
the name
Peeps.
Of the place. Yeah, but yeah, she's like, you know, Boobles, you know, adult video. And I was like, sure. And she's like, okay.
Gary's gawk and stroke. Sorry. I'm sorry. That is lowbrow. That is.
Gawk and stroke.
I apologize.
I demand a T-shirt from Gary's Gawk and Stroke right now.
Oh, please. Cheryl, get on that one.
I'm sorry, Cheryl.
Something else for our cafe press store.
I'm glad she booked Zach Whedon before that joke was made. But she asked me one time. She's like, oh, by the way, and you're just like, you know, I get an employee discount. So if there's anything you ever want from here, you just let me know, and I get 20% off. I'm like, all right. So one time I showed up to work, and she was still, you know, she was, you know, in the booth or whatever, and it was like another 20 minutes. So I'm like, okay. So I'm just wandering around the store. And, you know, and I was like however old, 19 or 20 or something. So it was like, you know, it was still a bright, shiny new world to me. And I remember just seeing, like, things that I never really knew. Like, I'm not going to say it was off-putting. It was just weird. It was like, if you remember, like, the first time you ever went to an adult store, it's not even that it's like, you know, it's not like it's icky or it's bad. You're just like, it's just, you can't really fathom some of it because
it's outside of your realm of possibility.
Yeah, you don't have a receptor in your brain for that. You're just going like, I don't really know what you would use that, you know, and so it was like a huge, you know, like a huge industrial sort of thing of like anal ease, you know, or whatever. And I'm like, what is, oh,
ladle.
I understand.
Well, like I went to one of those stores once with my friend Melanie, who was just one of those great, bright, shiny, sort of Zen girls who has no problem just saying anything that pops into her mind. And we were walking through one of those stores, and a very loud voice, she's like, well, what would you use a giant rubber fist for? And I'm going, shh, I don't know, but shh.
It's a visual aid used for teaching sign language. The fist means no. Actually means yes.
Nothing. But I remember she. I had seen like the little vials of the whatever, you know, the, like the VCR cleaner or something, and it was, you know, and it was called, you know, it was called like
Jungle
you know,
Juice.
You know, it was called like you know, Extra Pleasure with like three X's or something, and I was like, what? I was like, what's this? And I thought they were like, I thought it was like pills or something. She goes, oh, well, those are poppers. And I said, well, what? I don't understand. She goes, well, and she's like, you sniff it before. And I said, well, what does it do? And she described the whole thing. And it was sort of terrifying. And I realized that it's one of the same reasons that I don't get high, because where some people listen to the description and it sounds tantalizing or titillating or awesome or whatever, it sounded terrifying to me because here's one of the things that I live in fear of. I live in fear of heart attack. Like, some people are afraid of cancer, or they live in fear of, you know, getting whatever, you know, MS or, you know, your Alzheimer's. Not that I want any of those things, but I don't wake up every day like afraid of like thinking about the day that I'm going to get Parkinson's. But like every time I walk up a flight of stairs, I think about my heart just blowing out the front of my rib cage. I don't know why. I just have that fear. And she was describing it as a thing that like, and she said, and your heart rate triples, and then your vision goes fuzzy. And I was just like, stop! Like, you've got, you know, I'm not interested in taking whatever this is.
Yeah, it makes you feel like your brain is swelling up inside of your skull.
See, ask this and baby you can, what that feels
you can,
like.
You can feel the brain cells dying as it's happening.
Not just feel them, but you can hear them screaming
and
die.
And then you think to yourself, why would someone find this fun?
I think our friend Sam Kinison did the thing about amyl nitrate at one point. And he said, I'm not going to lie to you kids, folks, you know, I'm not going to, some brain cells are going to die. You will die a few years earlier, but really, what are you doing in those last few years of your life? It's worth it. And I, you know, there's nothing about that sounded appealing.
Well, yeah, and what boggles my mind is we'll have people come in and ask me where our section is on that particular item. I bring them over to the case, and they're like, okay, so what's better? Pepsi A or Pepsi B? What's better in the whole grand scheme? I'm just like, dude, you were asking the wrong cat. I don't know what
the people assume when they come into the store that, you know, because have we said exactly where we were? Do we say it?
I think we've said it at least
a fantasy location.
A fantasy for adult location.
Do people come in and they assume, and I'm not saying that you're not an adventurous, fun-loving guy who drinks deeply from the cup of life, but do people just assume that you are way more perverse and just like you've tried everything under the sun and just,
you know, the thing is, whether they expect that or not, or assume that or not, I kind of have to assume that role, because of the fact is, regardless of what it is that I'm selling this person, I have to have a wealth of knowledge on that topic to be able to sell it convincingly, not convincingly, but make sure that they're getting what they want and are, and I take it even one step further to make sure that they're buying something that's going to be safe for them. Because this might be something that they maybe heard about or they're curious about. You don't want to like learn how to drive with a Ferrari. You want to learn like on like a Pinto or something like basic, so that, you know, you won't do any severe damage to yourself. So
the fist is the Ferrari in this equation, I think.
Well, it's otherwise known as the Great American Challenge, and I will leave that where it lays. Any more clarification, I will not offer. But, you know, when somebody comes in, they're asking about they refer to them as poppers or amyl nitrate or whatever. You know, I have to, okay, here's our section here. Like, well, what's best? What is the best? What is the strongest that you've got?
Do you have is there a certain legal response you were supposed to give? In other words, are there ways you're supposed to answer that question and ways you're not?
We're not supposed to acknowledge poppers, because that can also refer to any number of...
Because it's a slang term for
it
illegal...
It is, yeah, exactly. Yes. So we have, just like, you know, we also sell glass, functional glass art, as it is. So we can't refer to it as a bong or a pipe or
because
whatever.
It's not.
It is a tobacco filtration system.
That's right.
Yeah. So based on that, we do have certain lingo that we have to adhere to.
It's weird that guys, I mean, no offense, that people come in and they just like look at you like you're Dr. Hump. You know, like you're the
pretty
guy
much,
who can answer everything. Honey, we're having issues with our sex life. This man will solve those problems.
You know, and you're coming to a stand-up comedian, which is like the worst possible. You know, I mean, if it was anybody else, it'd be totally fine. But
what do you have for a lady who's covered in sores?
What's funny is we actually have a parking structure upstairs, and we have stairs on our first floor leading up there, but they're all roped up. This is for employees only. And we have people coming in all day, every day. Like, so what's upstairs? And I have to come up with new and interesting things to say what's upstairs. So what's upstairs? Daycare center. Christian Science Reading Room, actually, is what's upstairs.
Awesome.
Gun range.
You know, the more convincing you can say that, the more just like, oh, okay. Because you know, they're already in a place that they can't believe in the first place. So for me to sell them what's upstairs, they totally buy me. No, I'm just messing with
you. I will say, here's what, parking. One of the things that I have noticed at Fantasy, and this is I've seen this at more than one location, so this must be like a hallmark of y'all's design. This must be one of your trademarks, that there are two entrances to Fantasy, at least the one downtown, and there's like one other one. There's one on Sandy. It's like
yes.
By the Tonic or something.
Yeah, the third. Yeah, right across the street.
Well, I think there's like a main door where you're coming off the street, mm-hmm. and then there's like some other door that's like way in the back that dumps you out in like an alley or something.
It's like you're in Singapore.
So I guess it's like you go in and you got nothing in your hands, but if you come out and you got like a shopping cart full of stuff or whatever, maybe you know, maybe that's a thing you'd like to not advertise to the public. Yeah. You know, that you go out the back door and right into the you know, because right into the trunk
of
the station wagon.
Or you don't
want to
park your car right in front.
Well, I hadn't thought about that, maybe. So that's consideration is what that is. Let's end this. This is your penis watch. There you go. Let's
look at my enormous penis.
Jesus.
And my troubles start a-melting away.
There's...
I take a look at my enormous penis.
We don't have to be anywhere.
No, I'm just wondering which of our fine advertisers wants to be adjacent to...
Hold on a second. Let me just...
Is there some emotional bleach we can scrub on that last segment?
Give me a second. Hold on. Let me just get a
flipping of a coin.
Let's see.
Come on, Harvey Dent.
Ah, all right. There we go. It's
heads.
Sorrell's Vintages. They are the lucky recipient of this spot in the Rick Emerson radio program today. Sorrell's Vintages has been in business since 1990. You can find them, and you probably know this place if you spend any amount of time on Hawthorne. They're at 3713 Southeast Hawthorne. They're right across from the Baghdad Theater.
Oh, yeah.
Right next to Powell's Books. You know the place I'm talking about.
Exactly, yeah.
It is really a fantastic place, and we've spent the last couple of days talking about the vintage side of the store. There are two sides. And it's not two separate buildings, but there's a little doorway you go through. And it's one side is mid-century modern furniture, which is sort of Mad Men era, Atomic mm-hmm. Age furniture.
Totally.
And it really, just to say a few more things about that before we talk about the other part of the business. The furniture is so beautiful, and it's authentic. It's not reproductions.
Yeah.
It's not like they got it and they just started churning it out in a factory somewhere. You know, the guys Daniel and Anton at Sorrell's Vintages, they actually travel all around the city and the state and the Northwest, and they go to other stores and to private you know, sellers and estate sales and just any place where people are selling furniture, and they look for stuff from that era and they pick out just the best examples. They don't just buy everything they see, so you end up with a store that's just jammed full of stuff, and it's, you know, and it's one of those kind of, you know, the stores we've all been to, places like that where it's dusty and grimy, and it's, you know, and there's a guy
totally.
Sitting there with like a bunch of mangy cats behind the counter, and everything's $5 off today, folks. You know, and you get the furniture home, it's like broken, and you got to clean it off. And you go to Sorrell's, and this stuff, first of all.
What, you need four legs for a table? What?
What are you, a Rockefeller? It's the stuff is really beautifully presented because before they put it on display, yeah, they'll clean it, they'll restore it, they'll do a little repair if it needs a little bit of repair, but it's, you know, but they're not. You know, they're finding stuff that looks great and is ready to go. The instant you take it home, you can put it out, and it's going to work as a piece of furniture. Everything from small decorative items, whether they're lamps or whether they're end tables or, you know, even something like an ashtray, all the way up to couches, to sofas. I almost don't even want to specify what it is because I'm thinking that Rick Emerson's going to own this before the year is out. But there is a great – It's like a bureau. I guess that's maybe the name for it. But it goes in your living room, and it's just it's a thing that I think you would probably have set like your cocktail set on top of.
Mm.
It's not exactly a table, not exactly a dresser.
Yeah,
it's
like
sort
a
of like
display
like a
area.
Table with drawers, almost, if that makes sense. But but the way they've got it set up, they actually have sort of a cocktail and a martini set up on top of it. And I think I remember seeing if you look at photos of my grandparents' place, they had something very similar that they used for that. So I think it was basically like a storage sort of bureau that went in your living room. And it's beautiful. And you look at the store and it's just, it is not nearly as expensive as you might imagine. It is comparable, certainly to, you know, to new furniture. And really, it's more, it is
if it's lasted this long, obviously,
that's
yeah.
the thing. And the quality is fantastic, and it's a lot less expensive than other vintage places that you go to. I just can't recommend that strongly enough. You go to the other side of the store, Terrell's, which is you know, it's connected. You just walk right through a little there's a little doorway there. You go to the other side, and the other side of the store is. And it's brand new items. It's not vintage stuff. It's stuff that is brand new, but they rotate through it through every season. They have a lot of, although the one constant there is they have a lot of Day of the Dead stuff. If you know, you see like a lot of decorative items.
Cool.
You know, whether they're, you know, whether they're paintings or whether they're, you know, things that will, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? There's sculptures and, you know, a lot of porcelain items that they make for Day of the Dead and a lot of handcrafted things. Those are kind of a constant. The rest of the store sort of rotates throughout the year. But if you're looking for something for Christmas, or maybe you're looking for something to accompany a larger item, you really can't go wrong at this place. I'm telling you. It's at 3713 Southeast Hawthorne. That's 3713 Southeast Hawthorne, right across from the Baghdad Theater, right next to Powell's Books. One side of the store is all vintage. The other side is all new merchandise. And they are a brand new sponsor of the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Please do tell me you heard about it here. Daniel and Anton are the guys there. Please tell me you heard it on the Emerson News Network. Sorrell's Vintages at 3713 Southeast Hawthorne.
TriMet adjacent.
You're listening
exactly.
to the Emerson News Network.
It is right it's in front of the 14, I think. Like 14 will leave you right there.
14? It is the 14, yes.
It's right next to Powell's. It really is just a fantastic place. Where are we in today's program? What have we not done? I have no idea. It's just all...
We have one other commercial spot we need to do. We've got the top five. Just, you know, chat about whatever we want to chat about. I did want to share just apropos of nothing, a friend of mine wrote on Twitter, doing keyword search for Anne Hathaway, a little disturbed by how many results there are for Anne Hathaway and feet.
Okay. Did you ever Google your own name to just see what the autocomplete is?
No.
Okay. Me either. Let's move on. Let's do the top five today, shall we? Are you prepared with that? Is that in the Dropbox?
It is
incidentally?
Indeed.
All right. So we will get today's top five. By the way, we'll talk about this more as we as 2010 becomes 2011. But I do want to mention that coming up in January, I believe, you are going to be you're going to be headlining a show at the Baghdad.
That is correct. Yes, and January 14th.
You can find out more about that, by the way, if you go to Facebook.com/ Jim Willig. That is JIMWILLIG, Facebook.com/ Jim Willig. This is your top five for Black Friday.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire.
Counting is wonderful, counting is marvelous, counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happiness, counting is ecstasy, I love to count, don't you?
And ladies and gentlemen, here is Don Taylor.
Well, this is your top five for Black Friday.
Excellent. How long did it take you to put this together?
About a half an hour.
Excellent. And so these are songs in which the unifying theme is the word black or the word Friday.
Yes, because right. It's Black Friday.
Well done.
And the honorable mention is Steely Dan, Black Friday.
I hate you. I hate you with everything in me. Ugh.
I know that you have a...
I hate Steely Dan.
Yeah. Really?
I hate Steely Dan more than I can...
I love Steely Dan.
The grimace on your face, it's epic.
How much would you hate me if I told you the reason I chose this was so I could play this song?
That's fine. Whatever. You know, that's okay. I'm all right. Here's the thing. I seem to be... It's not like this is ever going to make me love Steely Dan, but on the other hand, you know, at this point, I just sort of am so inured to it. Like, I just, you know, it's like a callus has built up over the Steely Dan receptor in my head.
Is this one of those things where you had to listen to it a lot when you were a DJ, or
well,
is it just something about Steely Dan you loathe?
That didn't help. I will say that I have never liked Steely Dan. But then working at an AOR radio station, which was AOR, which is really a format that doesn't exist much anymore, but AOR was sort of a half new rock, half classic rock. And but classic rock stations, for some reason, seeing as how there is no demonstrable rock of any kind in Steely Dan, It doesn't really make much sense, but classic rock stations love Steely Dan for some reason. They just can't get enough. And you know who else loves Steely Dan? And this is a truism. Anybody who listens to me and who's worked with radio engineers, you know this. Radio engineers love Steely Dan because Steely Dan records, and I believe this, Steely Dan records are apparently recorded with such fanatical attention to clarity and fidelity that they are one of the finest things you can use to test a brand new studio setup to see what it sounds like. So you will hear engineers. It's like guys who go to buy headphones or something, and they'll take like a CD with them to see like how it sounds. Radio engineers, when they build a brand new studio, when they test the monitors or they test the board or they're trying to make sure that the balance is correct, they'll use Steely Dan records because apparently Becker and Fagen were just such nerds and freaks for like putting it together correctly in the studio. It's the best way to tell what something really sounds like. So as a result, working in radio, you hear Steely Dan all the time. That exacerbated what was already a strong dislike of their music. I swear to God, if I could go back and just abort one band, seriously, if I could go back and just convince,
Are you Steely Dan?
Just go back and tell the mother, look, this is no world in which to bring children. I'm strongly suggesting that you do the right thing and get this taken care of today. There's a clinic down the road. It would be Steely Dan. I'm telling you.
No choice and don't choose.
I'm not saying this to be a jerk or to provoke a fight because I know how I love certain bands that people don't like and how if people say I got guys that whenever I talk about Led Zeppelin, they'll just fill up the thing with Robert Plant can't sing, Zeppelin sucks or whatever. And so I don't want to be hateful for its own sake.
Do you have any addresses for those guys?
That's what I mean. It's just like, you know how you kind of take it. It's like somebody insulting your kid. I will just say that at this point I have become even keeled about it enough. I'm zen with it. I can just say I really don't like Steely Dan.
Okay.
And I could quantify why that is. I don't know if there's much point. I will just say that my thing with Steely Dan is that the music sounds... Steely Dan, to me, has no soul. It is just a clinical...
It's a tool as opposed to entertainment.
Yeah, it's a clinical mathematical exercise.
Okay.
By some guys who were on their way to MIT and got waylaid by an A&R man. And they sort of lucked into a recording contract, but because they lack, any sort of actual humanity... Their music just is cold and is sterile and has no real heart to it. That's my take on it. So, and they're not the only ones who are like that. I mean, a lot of progressive rock is like that. That's why I don't like it. That's like Yes is that way to me. Yeah. I hear Yes and it's all just an academic exercise that has no heart. And that's kind of what this sounds like to me. It's not as bad as Kraftwerk, who are sort of the absolute zenith of that, but it is on the way to being like Kraftwerk.
Really?
Yeah.
You're going to throw Kraftwerk in there? Kraftwerk?
Yeah, I mean, this is like listening to music made by a calculator. I mean, and I know that not everybody feels that way. And you know what? They're famous and I'm not, so whatever.
It's your opinion. We validate it, but it's wrong.
I'm just saying. But you know what? I know a lot of Steely Dan fans who hear the Ramones and they just break out in hives because they can't play or whatever. So, it's a big world. See, Rick Emerson's come a long way.
Yes, he has.
We're proud of you.
I used to just get, apoplectically angry, though. I would hear Steely Dan, and I would just, Mr. Hand became Mr. Fist.
And when I said the word Steely Dan, I saw your eyes close.
I think I heard teeth grind.
Everything clenched up in your face. So.
I'm okay with it. Please, can we move on?
Yes, please.
Thank you. For love of God.
Number five for Black Friday is the Easy Beats, Friday on My Mind.
Well done. Now you know the musical family that these guys are part of.
No, I don't.
So the Easy Beats were centered around singer, songwriter, and guitarist George Young. George Young is the older brother of Angus and Malcolm Young from AC/DC.
No way.
He is also the guy when you look at the back of an AC/DC record and it says produced by Mutt Lange along with Vanda and Young. I forget Vanda for who that is, but the Young is George Young of the Easy Beats.
I had no idea.
Yeah, that's all one big family.
I just know that I love this song.
Yeah, so this guy was in this band and Malcolm and Angus were like, "That's a good gig. We ought to do that, mate." And so they formed AC/DC. And he lucked out because now he produces. Yeah, so he produces their record. So he has two generations of music success going on.
Yeah.
I can shop to this easily.
It's a great song.
Yeah.
See, the bad news is every time I hear something like that, some piece of music that I'm not really all that familiar with, and it's compelling and it has a pivotal point to the message in it. All I can think is how long before some corporate entity absorbs it and makes this their...
Oh, this has got to be a commercial already.
Yeah, somewhere, somehow.
There's got to be, I mean, if not here, then in Australia, there's got to be some sort of a, you know, or like a pub or something. It is, you know, or like a vacation, like a getaway.
The TGI Fridays.
Yeah, I mean,
TGI
it's...
Fridays
Monday,
on
I've got cheese sticks on my mind.
There's got to be like a Fridays on my mind jingle in this somewhere. No, I'd be astounded if that doesn't exist. This is a great song, though.
Well played.
Sounds a little bit like the Yardbirds.
Yeah.
Not a bad song at all. Excellent. These are your top five Black Friday songs, Don Taylor.
Number four, Johnny Cash, Man in Black.
Great song.
Well, you wonder why I always dress in black. Why you never see bright colors on my back. And why does my appearance seem to have a somber tone? Well, there's a reason for the things that I have on.
Here's the thing about Johnny Cash that kind of pisses me off. Because Johnny Cash lived, the title of coolest guy ever to walk the planet has been taken, you know? And because he went out just as cool as he came in, it's like it's his forever. You know, all we can ever be is like number two.
The thing is, though, Johnny has gotten to the point where beyond, you know, the zenith of being an incredible act that is timeless, he's become almost a cliche of himself, wherein, like, anybody that's like, you know, yeah, I like good music. I like Johnny Cash.
Right.
You know, so, like, so many, you know, D-bags.
Yeah, that's
there.
A hipster thing.
Yeah, it's like, you know, they can absorb Johnny. Like, no. Johnny needs to stay where he's at. This need to be part of your, like, well, no, Johnny's awesome. I like good music. I like Johnny Cash. Nah, see, no, you need to be able to not just like him, but know about him and truly get the full appeal of Johnny. Not just, like, throw him out there, you know, as a little titular point.
There's a moment in, I did this one-man show, this Bigger Than Jesus thing, and there's a line in there about, I don't remember, what I was talking about in the play, but it was just something about, you know, the kind of the age of irony and sort of hipster guys and, you know, and, but I was talking about how you can always, you know, you can always identify those guys because they have horn rim glasses and $90 shoes and a PBR belt buckle, and they're always
very
busy telling you about how they've always been into Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it. He did become one of those things that was sort of almost against his will, kind of co-opted, you know, by the alternative nation. But I mean, whatever. I mean, there's worse fates. But that, you know, but that's just one of those things that happens when you're awesome.
Yeah.
Do
you know how many hipsters it takes to screw in a light bulb?
No.
Some obscure number I'm sure you never heard of.
Well done.
Thank you.
Is that a Jim Willig original?
No, that is. I cannot take full credit for that. That is an awesome street joke.
I wonder, when did this song come out originally? Because I wonder where this was in contrast with Bob Dylan. Because on the one hand, Dylan obviously was influenced by Guthrie, and obviously you drew a lot from classic Americana. And so this could have predated Bob Dylan. But on the other hand, I could see Dylan coming out and then this song being a sort of countrified response to a Bob Dylan song. Because it sounds a lot like something that Dylan would have done in some of his more country moments. What a great song, though. And also just, and you know, and the other thing about doing a song called Man in Black, and it's hard to do. It's hard. It's like bands who sing about themselves in a song. You know, like there's got to be some rule that you can't mention yourself in a song until, yeah, like your third or fourth record, unless like you're in hip hop, in which case you can apparently get away with it earlier.
Or you're in Alter Bridge.
Man in Black was on Johnny Cash's 1971 album of the same name.
Okay, so far past Dylan. So yeah. But you know, bands who mention themselves in a song, you always run the risk of just looking like real douchebags when you do that. Like, I remember when the Escape Club did that, like in their second single, I was like, oh, you can't do that.
I can't believe you just quoted the Escape Club.
It's what I do. But Cash was able to do it by singing a song about his own appearance and simultaneously addressing and explaining and then solidifying the legend all in one song. It's a neat little trick that this song pulls off because it explains it and gives you sort of a, you know, a rationale and justification, when in reality, it's also just that it looks badass to be the guy in black. But then he, like, casts the die of, like, and he gives himself the title, I'm the Man in Black. And he could do that without looking like a dick or without looking self-important somehow. I mean, it's like, well, it's tricky to do.
It's one thing to be able to write great lyrics and deliver them, you know, convincingly. However, to be the guy that stomped out the light bulbs, the Grand Ole Opry, you know, to be the guy that went to, Folsom Prison.
Right.
To do a live show for the inmates.
To be the guy who defiled June Carter.
There we go. Hello. To have all those things in your wheelhouse, to call yourself the Man in Black, you know, it's like, you know, I'm basically going to put an official stamp on this. You know, I'm not going to gloat on it. This is not going to be my only trick in my repertoire, but I will definitely be the one that wears that on my back.
There's that great ad that Rick Rubin took out in Billboard magazine when it was like the third record he did for Rick Rubin. It was American 3, I think it was The Longest Road, whatever the subtitle was. But it got nominated for a Grammy. And of course, you know, the thing that everybody's talked about, is that Cash, when he did that whole comeback in the 90s, that he got no support from country radio at all. Country radio didn't play him. As Natalie Maine said, she said, they've got all the money, but they don't have Cash. And, you know, because he didn't get any mainstream country radio airplay because it was such a pop era. And so Rick Rubin took out this full page ad in Billboard, and it said, we would like to congratulate Johnny Cash upon receiving multiple Grammy nominations for his album American 3, and we would also like to thank the Nashville establishment and country music radio for all of their support. And then right below it was just that famous picture of Cash giving the middle finger.
Yeah!
And it was so awesome. And you're like, 100 years old and you're awesome and the coolest guy ever. So, all right, these are the top five Black Friday songs.
Number 3, The Cure, Friday I'm in Love.
Well done. The unplugged version. Or no, not the unplugged version. Okay. The count-in threw me off there. I love this song.
See?
I do too, mostly because it's so upbeat, and it's The Cure.
That's my exact opposite reaction to this whole thing. See, much like you have a detestment for
Steely Dan.
For Steely
you don't
Dan,
like The Cure?
I don't.
All right.
No, I don't.
Fine. No, that's how it's going to be.
No, well, okay. I can't hold anything against Robert Smith or the rest of the guys, but it's more like I don't like the band because the fans of that band drive me up an effing wall.
No, I could see
to
that.
Such a degree. I'm just like, ugh. You know, it's like you don't really, again, you don't appreciate it for the merit that it's worth. You appreciate it for a totally superficial
reason.
There's
things I hate because of the fans, but there's things that I hate because of the audience that's into them. Yeah.
So it's hard for me to actually give The Cure a fair shake.
I was introduced to The Cure by this hot goth girl that I went to school with.
Yeah,
of course you were.
It was. We didn't even know the word goth. We just called. She was like a new wave chick or whatever. But she was just like just gorgeous. Just and really was like nice to me for reasons I didn't like. She talked to me and stuff. And which was a new experience because girls didn't typically do that. Wasn't even they were mean to me. They just it was like I had some cloaking device on and they couldn't see me.
Can you get together after school and cut yourself?
sit and read Sylvia Plath to each other. But
swigs of Robitussin.
we never dated or anything because of course she was interested in my older friend. She was like, "Hey,
you're the ducky in that situation."
No, it's. Can I just tell you this? This is a true story. I'm not trying to be like, "Woe is me," because you know, whatever. But when I was in high school, the same girl who introduced me to The Cure, who I'd never heard, she asked me to come over and hang out with her at her house on New Year's Eve one year, and I was like maybe 15, 16, something like that. 14, but I was a teenager, I was in high school, and so one of the New Year, she asked me, she's like, "Well, do you want to come over and hang out? We can, you know, do all the dumb." She's like, "We can watch the Dick Clark special, or whatever. You know, it's nothing. But we weren't gonna like, you know." She wasn't like, "Come over and we'll party." She's like, "Just come over and hang out." I'm like, "Okay, I think I know what that means." It was the weirdest night. It was like one of those things where you feel in retrospect you were in some like a Judd Apatow film or like a John Hughes movie.
Because Delicatessen 2.
At one moment, we like walked over to visit her friend Jason, who lived next door, and his parents were gone. And she's like, well, let's go visit my friend Jason. I'm like, okay. So it's like 11 o'clock at night, and we're in her suburban house, and we walk to the suburban house next door in her cul-de-sac, and Jason is like up in his room listening to Hotter Than Hell by Kiss and sorting his weed on the Kiss album cover.
Yeah!
With a lava lamp going. He's like, hey, what's going on? She's like, hey, Jason, what are you doing? Just sorting my weed. And, you know, like Kiss is blaring. And I was like such a naive, you know, such a vanilla, like, you know. It wasn't even that I was like a goody two-shoes. I was just like a nerd. I just had no...
I mean, an adult.
Yeah, it was like, I don't, like, what's going on here? I don't understand. And then we went back over to her house, and anyway, so I'm thinking, like, okay, here's where the macking begins, you know? Because, like, it's going to be the stroke of midnight, and, like, you know, then we'll kiss,
so
and then...
Yeah.
And, but that night she had told me, she's like, hey, do you like The Cure? And I'm like, I guess. They're older stuff, maybe. Who are you talking about? And she's like, and she had the Disintegration album.
Ah.
And she's like, well, let me play a little something.
Which,
and
then Kyle says, is the best album ever.
Exactly. And so she put on Disintegration. I'm like, and it was really great. It's like she started with Fascination Street or something. And I'm like, this is awesome. And it was awesome. And you know, and then she played, I think just by accident, by coincidence, then she put on that Let's Go to Bed song on it or whatever, and I'm just like, okay, things are looking up. And I was totally convinced that I was gonna like score by the end of the night. And then I swear to God, at one point she just goes, So I was wondering, and I'm like, yes. And she goes, do you think your friend Eric likes me?
Oh God.
It was so depressing. It's the worst moment.
I punched you in the libido.
Seriously, it was like Godzilla versus Bambi. It just sort of a, I don't know, maybe, hold on. I'll call him and ask. It was just so depressing.
For those of you not old enough to know those references, more like a Cloverfield versus Shame.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. But anyway, but out of that, I got a huge love of The Cure because I'd never heard them before, so... I can't even imagine. You guys probably have the same. Well, maybe not you, but Dawn, you probably have the same story. I can't even imagine how many hours of my life I spent in high school sitting in like a darkened room listening to Disintegration and just being sad. You know, just sitting there, but sad in a way that you sort of love, in the way, you know, where you, yeah, like it when you're a teenager, where you just can't get enough of your own pain.
Yeah.
This is a great song. It really is. I've heard that Robert Smith doesn't like this song, but I don't know if that's true or not.
It's his Piano Man.
Maybe. Maybe because it's so upbeat. Maybe he doesn't like it because he feels like it sticks out too much, but it's a great song.
I spent a lot of times in high school with other friends mocking Robert Smith.
He's easy to mock.
Well, yeah. It's just, you know, we imagine... like Robert Smith doing like kind of like his own, like if you give like Robert Smith his own Tonight Show appearance, she's like, hello, this is Robert Smith of The Cure, and these are my depressed friends. This is Robert and my depressed friends. Hello, Robert. Hello. So yeah, it's like basically
this guy sitting in the couch staring at the floor.
Yeah.
Hey, you might know this. Was Robert Smith the model for Edward Scissorhands?
I don't think so. I think Edward Scissorhands was well before The Cure.
Okay. I wondered if stylistically...
I think it predated The Cure.
Interesting.
The thing is, you know, Tim Burton, you know, kind of like me, Tim Burton's old enough that he was a goth before there was such a thing as goth.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, so he did the whole thing. It's like, you know, back when Tim Burton and I were used, it was like just called being depressed and wearing black all the time.
We called it adolescence.
So you probably, even though you're 22, you probably did not sit around in high school and listen to The Cure.
No, I did not.
You listened to Bauhaus.
I was listening to Rudy Valli on my Victrola.
Okay.
Wow.
You were just listening. You were just listening to that, and then watching that silent film of the guy shooting at the camera over
right.
and over again.
Exactly. All right. That one silent film clip of the train crashing as it went off the end of the track.
Well timed. This is your Black Friday top five, Don Taylor.
Number two, AC/DC, Back in Black.
Yes!
Well, Don. Wow. Excellent. It's hard to imagine there was a time when this song didn't exist.
I know.
You know, this record is 30 years old.
Shut the front door.
Gonna be 31 next year. 31 years of age. And it still sounds, and I'm not just saying this because I'm an old guy, because a lot of stuff, like even from the late 80s, early 90s, you know, whatever, that sounds dated and bad.
Yeah.
This record sounds as good as the day it came out.
This just reaches right into the middle of you and grabs you by the diaphragm.
It
and
is
squeezes.
Primal. It really is.
And what's more amazing is the fact that this is the first post-Bon Scott album with Brian Johnson. And it's like, okay, we're gonna relaunch the band. We're not gonna cancel it out. We're bringing you on. Kick us in the teeth as hard as you can.
Yeah.
And this song still delivers to this day.
I can go on and on and on and on about AC/DC and about Back in Black specifically, but I mean, it's a perfect album. It's flawless.
Yes.
Front to back. There's not a bad song on it. I mean, it is like even the stuff that shouldn't work, like Let Me Put My Love Into You. Let me cut your cake with my knife. It works because they just sell it. They have no shame, you know? They know that if you sing it loud enough, like, it becomes cool.
Word.
Well, but, as I've talked before, one of the reasons that I don't like a lot of, like, you know, a certain hard rock, and I never have, is I don't like singers that have that really screechy
right.
voice. Which is one reason, like, I hate Rush, for
right.
example. Can't stand it. Can't stand the sound of his voice. This particular album is, like, just flies in the face of all of that.
Totally.
Even though
he's the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this song is I've since moving out from Pennsylvania, I've had fantasies about driving up to my old stomping grounds, jet black Shelby Mustang convertible, Pioneer kicker speakers in the trunk, cranking this to the umpteenth degree, and then just getting up being the coolest dude ever. Because this song, if you know the words, if you've heard the song before, if it's touched you in any way, it has that potential to make you feel like you are it. You are Billy Dee Williams, you are whatever.
You're Billy Dee Williams.
Dude, you're gonna hate on Billy, you're gonna hate on Lando?
Is that where you're back and black?
No, oh, how dare you, sir.
Sorry.
No, all this right. song, it supersedes race, religion.
Road 45.
Exactly.
No, it is universal.
ACD, yes.
I will tell you this, actually, that it's not like Rick Emerson now speaks for the black community. That I
finally,
I finally,
as a black man, Rick Emerson,
you are honorary because of the McRib.
I don't even remember who wrote it now, but I remember reading an article one time about Back in Black, like on its 20th anniversary or 25th, and it was somebody writing in Spin. But it was a black author, and he actually said that one of the things about it, he said it was the one thing he could put on at his house, like if he was having people, and no matter who you were, your cultural background, whatever, it was one of the few albums that everyone could agree on.
Hells yeah.
And he said he believed that it was, especially for like just a bunch of pasty-ass Australian white guys, that they were amazingly rhythmic in their own kind of way. And this song is really taking that to the, I mean, if you listen to the, you know, this is an exaggerated example almost, because the song, you know, especially you hear it gets sampled so much, because it's got that, you know, it's almost like a metronome, it's so rhythmic, but it's like they do, but AC/DC has the combination of, they're like the Stones in that they're rhythmic, but it also swings.
Yeah.
You know, it's tight but loose, as they say, where it's very martial and militant, but at the same time, it has a certain groove to it, and it's, yeah.
People, yeah, I've heard it said before that AC/DC's music is, well, they've got like maybe four or five basic templates for songs
yeah.
that they put out, and that's pretty much it. I'm just like, well, no, what you're saying is they've got the fundamentals down to such a degree
yeah.
that they can crank out those four different types of songs, and they will sell every single time.
And it really is amazing that they were able to come back after Bon Scott died, because he was
huge.
Such a huge, and he was the focal point of the band, not
the
Angus
tiniest
Young.
Tiniest and pastiest.
Yeah. And that they got this guy, in the, you know, who nobody'd ever heard of. He was
with
this
Andy Cap hat on.
Seriously. One of these days, I'll do it maybe sometime next week. I'll do Hell's Bells as a greatest songs ever, because, you know, it's, yeah, I mean, that they not only came back, but came back with what is considered by many people to be, like, the definitive AC/DC record.
Oh, yeah.
And, again, the fact that this is goddamn 30 years old.
Yeah.
And it's still, I mean, will just beat your ass. It's just, it's awesome. Excellent. Well done, Don Taylor.
And you'll ask for more. Yes. Well played indeed.
Because
we still have one left.
Because I am that guy. We'll just be shamelessly manipulative here for a second.
Okay.
Say, before we do number one, but first a long-distance dedication. This is, all right. Now, I would just have to say that if you are listening to this program and you say what a fine piece of broadcast entertainment this is, that they're going from the ridiculous to the sublime to the musical to the crude to the subtle to the cosmopolitan to the crude, and often within the same story, within the same sentence, weaving together many threads in a multicolored comedic tapestry. Who is it that makes this fine show possible? And we say that...
Who, indeed?
It is not only all of the listeners who chip in their 32 cents, that's one quarter, one nickel, and two pennies a day to hear this fine broadcast, but it's our business partners as well, including, as of this year, ChristmasMountainTrees.com. And you can find out more about them, just like it sounds, by going to their website, ChristmasMountainTrees.com today. Now, they actually opened today. Today is the first day that they're open. Today, November 26th, they opened at 10 a.m. Regular hours are 10 to 4:30, Wednesday through Friday, Saturday, Sunday, 9 to 4:30 till December 19th. And if you have never had the true Christmas experience, the way that you imagine it, the way you visualize it, or if you had and you want your kid to have the same experience, or you want your family, maybe you've got married, or you're with somebody for the first time, or you got your own house, you're no longer, you know, just like living in a whole, you know, like a house of dudes somewhere, and you want to have a Christmas that lives up, that measures up to the way that you've always imagined it, there are a few better ways you can do that than by going to ChristmasMountainTrees.com and finding out about the family farm that they run. It's a third-generation family farm, been there since 1942, and this is what they do. They grow trees all year long, year-round. It's not just like a thing they do, it's like bring in extra bucks, or that they're going to open up like a lot somewhere, you know, downtown, like in front of the Walgreens, you know, or something, and be pitching you a tree. It is a farm of 85,000 trees. It's a gorgeous view.
Wow.
You can see three of the Cascades from up there. You go there, and it's an entire experience. You go, you sit in front of a fire, they bring there's a wagon, it's sort of a tractor slash wagon. You get in the back, and it's, you know, they've got it built so people can sit in the back. You've got your hot cider they give you, and they will actually take you through, and you look at, you know, one stand of trees after another for as long as you want. You can stay there all day if you want, till you find the tree if you want, and they will actually, and you see the tree in the ground. They've grown, and they'll actually take the tree, and they'll take the excess needles off. They'll take it out, they'll wrap it, they'll bale it with one line of twine that goes all the way around it. So when you get it home, you take off the twine and it springs into place and it's perfect.
Nice.
They'll fasten it to your car. They'll let you actually cut it down yourself if you want. They've also got some pre-cut if you feel like you just want to go off and, you know, pick one of those. And then while the guy is actually taking care of the tree and fastening it to your car, you go and you sit in front of the fire again. They refill your drink, and you have it. It's a gorgeous view. It's beautiful. And it is one of those things. It's like you are inside your own Franklin Mint commemorative egg.
and if you and your lovely girlfriend Malia would like to join us, we're going to be going there.
That's right.
A week
from tomorrow, Saturday, December 4th, Dawn Taylor and I will be there, along with probably our respective significant others, and perhaps Cheryl or Bruce or listeners, whoever. We're going to be there on Saturday the 4th. We'll figure out the time and let people know. But we are going to head on up there.
And we'll ride on the wagon and we'll look at the trees.
It's just I'm just such a big nerd for Christmas. I mean, I can be, and as we were saying earlier this week, we can be really reflexively cynical about things and whatever, but I love Christmas. I love Christmas like nobody's business.
Well, I love the fact that they respected Christmas, or actually they respected Thanksgiving enough to wait until today. Because everywhere else you go, there's decorations up and everything else well before, right after Halloween. It's like, let's ignore Thanksgiving, whatever. This sponsor, as awesome as they are, wait until today and then officially to embrace the official Christmas season.
Well, and this is what they work toward all year long. Because, again, this is their business. They run a family farm, and people talk so much about support the American farm. Well, tell you what, this is actually an American farm run by local, by local people. It's been here. His grandfather started it in 1942. And so they've still got it now, three generations later. So find out more by going to ChristmasMountainTrees.com. It is ChristmasMountainTrees.com. And be listening next week. We'll give you some details about our excursion to this fine place. It's going to be happening next Saturday, the 4th. So there you go. All right. We have been conducting the top five today. These are the top five Black Friday songs. Dawn Taylor, what might number one be?
Number one would be the Rolling Stones' Painted Black.
Well done.
Crank it up where applicable.
I see a Richter and I want it painted black. No colors.
It's a great song.
Yes.
I don't know if this song is about anything in particular. I mean, because it sounds like he's at a funeral, right? Because he says, I see a red with cars and they're all painted black with flowers and my loved one never to come back.
Yeah. I have to admit, I have this weird connection with it in my head because there was a sketch. Do you remember the Tracy Ullman show?
Yeah. Yeah.
And she would do these musical numbers that there would be an entire comedy sketch and it would lead into her doing a musical number. And she did this thing where she was a housewife who was trying to paint her kitchen and couldn't decide on a color to paint the kitchen. And her husband got mad at her and yelled at her and said, when he got home, he wanted it painted. And so she starts singing. She instructs the painters to just paint everything black. And she starts singing this song. And it just comes in hard. And she just rocks it while she's, like, running around the kitchen just slapping black paint on everything. And so now, of course, that's what the song is about to me in my head now. It's about a woman painting her kitchen.
I think it was in Full Metal Jacket is where maybe I'm remembering it from.
See, for me, I was going to say, it's been so synonymous with the Vietnam War. I honestly thought that that's what he was reflecting on.
I don't know, actually. I almost don't want to know what it's about if it's about something specific, maybe.
It's such a versatile song. Let it be interpreted by the listener and by no one else.
That sounds like such an obvious thing to say, but it's like it can be easy to look at Mick Jagger, especially, as such a parody, such a caricature. But, I mean, the Rolling Stones have created... You don't even really realize how many songs the Stones have created that you know word for word. I mean, how many classic songs one group has created. And when you think that this is one of, 50 that they've done.
This song is just amazing because it has just that insane overdrive Charlie Watts drums going on. Plus this kind of Middle Eastern guitar sound to it. It's just an odd mishmash of stuff.
It also has like a funeral dirge, but like upbeat almost.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like celebrating.
Like a funeral pyre.
Yeah, exactly. Like the flames getting higher and higher and everything else. So.
And it is, I mean, the Stones really, when they were at their peak, and I don't know when the song
came out.
I want to say like
assuming that they're not. I mean, they haven't retired yet.
That's true.
I've always said that if I was in a band, I would always want to say that I was inspired by like Bridges to Babylon era Stones or something. No. We draw all inspiration from Voodoo Lounge. I'm being a dick. I'm sorry. I shouldn't say that.
Tattoo You is
special hell, in the words of Shepherd Book.
But they were so. They had this great, like, really, like, badass nihilism, that most bands are just not able to, that they're not really able to get right without it sounding corny or cheesy. But it's like, we played on Greatest Songs Ever Made the other day, we had Gimme Shelter.
Yeah.
And, Mick Jagger talked about the whole album is so apocalyptic sounding. And, like, at the end of Paint It Black, where he says, he says, I want it black as night, black as coal. I want to see the sun blotted out from the sky, which sounds like bad teenage poetry if you just say it. But it's like because he says it, you're like, yeah, that's, go Mick. And he just seems.
It's like he's ripping off Live Journal word for word.
And he totally makes it sound believable and sort of awesome. That's why I have always believed that thing about him being the devil in American Pie. When Don McLean talks about seeing, seeing the devil singing on stage, I've always believed the thing that was Mick Jagger because he just at that time seemed so like demonic. All of their lyrics and his presence and the whole Altamont thing, I've always believed the thing that American Pie, that he was the devil in the song.
Wow.
Apparently the sitar riff in this song is purely because Brian Jones had just learned to play the sitar from George Harrison, so he needed to use it in a song somewhere.
See, that pisses me off. Where it's like, it wasn't even like, it was like, well, I don't know, let's just put it together and see what works. And then, out comes this. I hate stories like that. Where you just like to think that they labored over it and they sweat blood to create this song. He's like, I don't know, we tossed it off in 3 minutes.
I'm really into the sitar this week. I want to use it.
Where did you find that piece of info?
On Wikipedia.
Okay, there it is. There's the small... gray area that you can absorb that.
I can think it's
It might not be true.
There we go.
Might not be true.
There we go. Just enjoy the song, man.
It's like they used to ask John Paul Jones, so tell us about how you came to be in Led Zeppelin. He'd go, well, I answered an ad in the back of the paper. which is probably not true, but F that guy. You shouldn't say that. Jesus. All right. We should end the program. We've been here for this show has been on for 3 hours now, so
Sweet.
We should probably... That's your 32 cents worth right there.
Yeah.
Bastards. All right. Mr. Big Jim Willig, we'll be back again next Friday with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. Do you know who you're talking about next week, or is it going to be a,
no clue.
A reveal?
No clue as of yet. I'm still reeling from this week's.
Oh, I hope it's Carrot Top.
Wait for it.
Now you've made it happen. So you think it's
Gallagher, baby. Why do we park in a driveway and drive in a parkway?
Big Jim Willig, Facebook.com/JIMWILLIG. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler. Chief of staff is Cheryl Kanakoa. Have a good weekend. We will see you Monday at noon for Legion of News. We'll have an encore of today's Legion of News following a brief musical interlude here and an encore of this very fine radio program. As always, made possible by a generous grant from y'all. It is Friday, November 26th, 2010, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, have a good weekend. Be safe. Thanks for listening. Bye now.